The farmer in the dell, the farmer in the dell. Hi-ho, the derry-o, the farmer in the dell.
Indiana's agriculture tradition is well documented, from Indy 500 winners drinking milk to county fair midways and local 4-H animal exhibits. Farming is celebrated. But the national conversation around race is largely absent in many rural Indiana communities. From Indiana Public Media, Brock Turner has the story.
You'd be forgiven if you drove through Lyle Station and thought it was like any other farm town.
I grew up here too. I was fortunate enough to see my uncle's farming and to see the other black farmers and to live in this community when it was more of a community.
Settled in the early 1800s, Lyle Station was a bustling community and a haven for thousands of black farmers. It offered freedom and a pathway to economic vitality. This land has been in the Greer family since before the Civil War, but over time, the community that once defined this place has eroded.
It was a farming community. There were other gentlemen, you know, at the end of the day, at the end of the weekend, you know, to have fish fries and to sit back and they're happy because their crops are in, their crops are growing. When Dad was here, this was full black farming community.
Denise and her father, Norman, are now almost exclusively surrounded by white farmers.
We're kind of, what you call it, landlocked to where they've bought stuff all around us. So they're sitting there waiting for that opportunity to just get the rest, you know.
At 84, Norman has farmed this family land his entire life, but it's becoming more difficult.
You don't see the black farm expanding, getting bigger. They're getting smaller.
Smaller operators, regardless of race, are struggling as margins throughout agriculture shrink. The get big or get out mantra is what many live by. However, white farmers don't experience the racism many black and other farmers of color say is routine. Whether accessing credit, participating in government programs, or dealing with subtle racism in town when working with local vendors, many farmers of color say the problems are systemic. Even the recent COVID relief plan contained a program that was supposed to help socially disadvantaged and minority farmers. But to date, primarily due to a federal court ruling in Wisconsin, farmers across the country haven't been able to see any of the estimated $4 billion that was promised. For farmers like Greer, this is just another example of setbacks black farmers have faced for decades. John Boyd, president of the National Black Farmers Association, agrees.
And I want to be real clear here. It took place on the watch of Republicans. It took place on the watch of Democrats. And it took place on the watch of the American people. Everybody's guilty here because we didn't step up and stop it.
He admits he's disappointed with how the COVID program has been rolled out, but believes the resistance is part of a bigger problem.
There's a real division between white America now and black America, and even a bigger division between a black farmer and a white farmer. You can feel the tension.
Back in Lyle Station, all hope isn't lost. Greer's grandson, DeAnthony, encouraged by his grandfather, is about to graduate with a degree from Tennessee State University in agribusiness. While he's not sure he'll be taking over the family farm, he understands the close ties farmers, regardless of race, have with their land.
Understand that we want to be out here too. We want the same things you do. We want to be able to carry on family legacies, family land, and be able to grow our own, like I said, legacies as well. So just take into consideration what we want and how we feel.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Brock E.W. Turner in Lyle Station, Indiana.
You were staying at a plantation initially when you began covering this story?
Oh my God, yes. I think the word former is important there, but so the New York Times, there were no hotel rooms, right? Katrina hit, and suddenly all these evacuees are filling up all the hotel rooms, and reporters need to cover the story. So Baton Rouge, an hour from New Orleans, the Times had like 25 reporters, something like that, down there. And so what they ended up doing is renting this former plantation that was used for weddings and events and things like that. We just rented it out indefinitely. So we stayed in what I have to assume were former slave quarters that were still standing. It was preposterous. It was just this grand irony that this story that was all about race and, you know, where the place we end up is a former plantation.
Mm. Context of white supremacy.
No, it's crazy. It's crazy.
It was just 1 week ago that Hurricane Ida roared through southeastern Louisiana. People are cleaning up and trying to put their lives back together now. When Gulf Coast residents decide not to evacuate ahead of a big storm, they then ask themselves, where do I want to ride it out? NPR's John Burnett has the story of one family that found safety in an unlikely structure.
When the Banner family sought shelter from the storm, they looked for the sturdiest building in the tiny community of Wallace, Louisiana. So they decided to ride out Ida in the big house on the Whitney Plantation.
Oh, wow. It's just unbelievable.
Twin sisters Joy and Joe walked through the grounds, strewn with toppled trees, building material, and broken limbs.
Those trees were snapped. They're gone, and everything looks so different.
The Banners are Black. They've lived on this rich alluvial soil beside the Mississippi River for generations. And they say their enslaved ancestors helped construct this Creole plantation house 230 years ago for a German planter and slave owner named Jean-Jacques Heidel. As it happens, it was to this handsome white-columned manse that the Banner sisters and their parents, Harriet and William, fled last Sunday.
And just being back here and going through the experience of being in a hurricane in that house, and then literally, I mean, that was our place of refuge. This really made me appreciate the skill, the craftsmanship of the enslaved people. They were not able to have this kind of house for their own protection when a hurricane would hit them.
Whitney Plantation is not like the other historic plantations located along the famed River Road that winds along the Mississippi. This acclaimed plantation museum was the first in America dedicated to the telling of the slave experience. Joy Banner, who lives a mile and a half away, is communications director here. She unlocks the padlock and lets us into the dining room, which is furnished with elegant table settings from that era.
And this is where we were for 17 hours.
At one point, the wailing wind stopped, and they saw the sun again, and they thought the storm was over. But when the winds picked up again, they hurried back to the big house. The eye of Hurricane Ida was passing directly over the Whitney, but they were safe.
You can feel that this is pretty, you know, thick plaster on brick that is used for the construction of the bottom portion of the house, which is where we stayed.
Man, wow, look at these walls. They're more than a foot thick.
And this was built in 1791. Yeah. It's seen hurricanes before. It's seen Betsy. It's seen, now it's seen Ida. I think
her sister, Joe.
So ironic to run to the big house. You know, I never imagined as a descendant of the enslaved that we'd be running to this house.
The big house at the Whitney Plantation is considered one of the finest examples of decorated wood architecture along River Road. In one room, you can still see the initials of the mistress, M.H., monogrammed on the ceiling of the parlor. Again, Joy Banner.
As much security and safety as a house provided, there's still a sense of you don't belong here. Like the house is not for you.
Ida caused extensive damage on the Whitney Plantation. The original slave cabins stood, but two sharecropper cabins that were brought onto the property were flattened. The ancient oak trees lost a lot of limbs, but they survived. The pigeon roosting houses are okay. The stately whitewashed Antioch Baptist Church, which was built by emancipated slaves and moved here from across the river in 1999, was also heavily damaged. The Banner sister's mother, Harriet, says she'll never forget the day of the storm.
It was just so loud, and it sounded like maybe the train was coming through. And you look out and you saw the beautiful trees, and they were just all over the place. It was terrifying.
Harriet Banner believes it wasn't just the thick walls and cypress shutters that protected them. There's a Catholic tradition down here in St. John the Baptist Parish where, when a hurricane is coming, you sprinkle bread that was blessed on St. Joseph Day around your house to protect it.
So I brought my St. Joseph bread, and then when I got to the big house, I'd sprinkle holy water and threw the bread around, you know, around the house, and I kept my rosary in my hand. So I prayed, I gave it up to him, and I said, Lord, it's in your hands. And That's what calmed me down.
Whitney Plantation has closed for the time being. The management is seeking donations for what will be expensive repairs. As for the big house, it lost its chimney, some cedar shingles, and a few windows, but it stood strong against the storm, just as it was built to. John Burnett, NPR News, Wallace, Louisiana.
For Ms. Brown, you and an even retired firefighter in Florida, you all are in areas where they've had so much talk about what they're calling climate change. I know some folks, the language will change. They'll use, you know, other terminology to refer to this. I know this is one that's kind of contested. Some people don't think that such a phenomenon exists. You've been in the Louisiana area and had to evacuate for a few storms. Do you invest in the notion of so-called climate change? And do you think that's impacting what's happening in your area?
Absolutely. You know, we talk about climate change is important. It's unfortunately an issue. Sometimes when we talk about it in the Black community, our, you know, ears aren't turned on as much. I wish we would stop using phrases like climate change and start using phrases like environmental racism.
Hurricane Ida and its aftermath left dozens of people dead and lives and properties destroyed. It is a wake-up call about the accelerating effects of climate change caused by the burning of fossil fuels. In a minute, we'll hear from the mayor of Jersey City on what happened there. But first, we go to the Gulf Coast of Louisiana, where 15 Native American tribes were in the direct path of Hurricane Ida last week. The Houma Nation is the largest, with 19,000 members spread across six parishes, and it suffered some of the worst damage. August Krepel is the chief of the Houma Nation, and he joins us now from Gretna, Louisiana. Welcome, sir, to the program.
Well, thank you for having me. Alito, Humasia, Yupiche, Miko Omas. I want to thank you for having us on here so we can share our story, you know, with so many people.
Well, please tell me your story. What are you seeing right now? What are you facing in the wake of the storm?
This is one of the largest storms to hit the Louisiana coast. And all our people live, you know, along the Gulf Coast, and some of them are fishermen and things like that. We're a state-recognized tribe, not federal-recognized, so we get no state privileges, anything. Anything we want or need, we have to try to get it ourselves.
I was about to ask, what are your tribe members asking for? What do they need? What are they saying?
Well, some of our people evacuated to shelters. Some of our people, we have a working relationship with the Mississippi Band of Choctaws, and they took some of our people up that way. The rest of our people that had to move and have no place, they go stay with family and friends.
Have you been able to get some help?
We have help that's on the way. The Lumbee tribe in North Carolina and different places, and the churches are getting trucks loads of stuff to come down. As for today, it's, you know, 110 degrees in some place with heat index. So we're not only dealing with, you know, the aftermath of the storm, we're also dealing with heat down here, you know.
Your day job is as a firefighter. I understand you've worked 24-hour shifts for more than a week now.
Yeah, actually, I'm a firefighter. It'll be 40 years next month. And, you know, we're working from most of the time from sunup to sundown. And, you know, each day brings something different.
You mentioned that you are a state-recognized tribe, but not a federally recognized tribe. How does that affect the kinds of support and relief that you can get from the federal government?
Well, as a state-recognized tribe, majority of the time we don't get any support from the federal government. We hardly get any support from the state government. You know, again, we're the largest tribe in Louisiana, and we have to wait in line just like everybody else in the state. 90% of the help we get is help that people reached out to us or we reached out to them. You know, it's, and I've been to Washington several times fighting for federal recognition because it brings in funds and education for our kids. It brings in help programs for my elders. You know, this is a very big fight for me. We're the same people that they wouldn't let me in the public schools until the 1960s. And now we have to fight so hard to prove that we're Native for us to be federally recognized.
So what do you think you most need at this particular point in time?
Water, we got in touch with, you know, different organizations about bringing in generators and blue tarps and equipment like chainsaws and cleaning supplies and baby products. You know, I mean, we're still in the blind because some places we can't get to. We have low cell phone service. We hardly have any internet, and we have none down in Florida, Terrebonne and Lafourche Parish.
Chief August, how are you feeling after seeing all this devastation and knowing that so many in your community are hurting and maybe even have to leave?
Well, you know, it hurts. You know, again, as a native pastor, I got to give my glory to God every day just for waking me up for that day. But I have to lean on him to give me strength to not only serve as my job as a firefighter, but also to serve 19,000 citizens of my tribe. One of the worst things that hurts is to see how much my people's life changed just in a few hours, and there was nothing I can do about it.
August Crapel is the chief of the Houma Nation in Louisiana. We wish you all the best in your recovery, and our thoughts will be with you.
Thank you and appreciate it. And if anyone, you know, wants to, you know, donate and help out in any kind of way, they can reach out to unitedhomanation.org. Even if you just send in love and prayers, we appreciate that.
A terrible thing to waste. Environmental racism and its assault on the American mind. Written by Harriet A. Washington.
Antonia Juhas, I want to bring you into this conversation. Oil and energy investigative journalist Bertha Fellow, whose new article for Rolling Stone is headlined, Hurricane Ida Pounded Louisiana's Cancer Alley. Its residents need help and demand change. Antonia, you tweeted yesterday, I believe, the extent of damage done from the fossil fuel and petrochemical industry here, from leaks, spills, flaring, ruptures, chemicals, releases, et cetera, as a result of Hurricane Ida, maybe ultimately among the worst of such events ever recorded. Put this in context for us as you head back home to New Orleans and the significance of Sharon as an environmental leader leading the struggle to challenge the fossil fuel industry that contaminates so much of the community that she and others are in.
And I want to say good morning to Sharon, especially as another storm is heading her way and our way, and wishing her safety. So, you know, basically, there's several compounding problems happening right now. There isn't power to almost all of Cancer Alley, where Sharon lives. And some of the refineries and petrochemical facilities have power, but sort of shockingly, a lot of them don't. And because they don't, they are releasing horrible flares, black, dirty flares. They've been flooded. They're releasing chemicals. They're spilling. And they're not expected to have power for another 2 weeks. So you have the impacts on the citizens, on Sharon and her community, of not having power, of not having assistance. And then you have this petrochemical and fossil fuel industry that might spend 2 weeks unable to repair itself. And so you have compounding problems on top of each other, and that's just the onshore problem. Offshore, there's a whole host of drill ships, platforms, infrastructure that we know that's been damaged, but they can't get out there. So the Coast Guard has done flyovers, but the companies haven't gotten out there, so we still don't know the extent of the damage offshore. And part of that, again, is this power outage problem, which is still plaguing the state. That said, we already know of at least 350 reported spills in the Gulf and on land waters. I think the impacts are going to be, as you read, devastating, continue to be devastating when it's all taken into account.
And Antonia, can you talk about what has been Marathon's response after Sharon Lavigne's video documentation of that September 5th oil spill?
Yes, Marathon said to me that they noted that the spill had happened at that tank farm with the crude pouring over the edges, but that it hadn't contaminated air or water. But then I saw that they had actually filed with the State Department, Department of Environmental Quality, that there was impacts to both water and land. So I think the full extent, again, of that damage is yet to be known, because all we have right now is what Sharon is able to see with her eyes and report, and what the company is telling us. And this is a problem throughout the state, because the environmental regulator, the Department of Environmental Quality, is also having problems getting out, but also their air monitoring stations, 15 of them were out, I assume for outage, by the refineries, by the petrochemical plants to monitor. That's just the air quality aren't there. So the access to information is extremely limited, also because of the ongoing storm damage, just making it difficult to get to areas.
You even have Shell, Antonia, an offshore oil site, preventing not picking up 100 of their offshore oil workers on the platform as the storm hit. They were stranded there?
Yeah, so there's two platforms. One, a Shell drill ship. Yes, they left 100 workers in the island platform, which is entirely bizarre because generally waiting workers from offshore platforms is standard procedure. We know from the videos that these workers were media that the ship took on extensive water. We know that it had to lose some of its equipment onto the ocean floor. They were evacuated. They finally are moving that rig off to Mississippi. They've been out on the water since the storm. That's only one of Shell's platforms. Another one of their facilities that takes on 200,000 barrels of oil a day and natural gas a day, it's a transit hub, has also been damaged during the storm, and we don't know the extent of the damage. There's oil sheens in the water from another drill ship. The commodities markets are already reporting that this is the worst harm to the oil sector from in the Gulf Coast since at least 2005 with the combination of Katrina and Rita. And I think, again, that's a sign that what we're going to start seeing is because of the extent of the period of damage, not having electricity, the winds, the high winds, that we're going to see more and more evidence of extensive spills, releases, ruptures, damages onshore, offshore, which we're already seeing.
And Sharon, I'd like to ask you what those who argue that the petrochemical industry is vital to jobs in Louisiana, what's your response to them, especially after crises like this?
My response is, what's more important, a human life or job? It's not that we're against industry that's trying to harm us, take our health and take our lives. We want to live. We want to breathe clean air. These industries are not allowing us to breathe clean air or drink clean water.
And finally, Antonia, Entergy. I remember seeing all the Entergy vans after Hurricane Katrina. Now, a million customers lost power after Ida. Still hundreds of thousands in darkness, no electricity. The private company and what should be done about it?
Yeah, so only about 50% of Louisiana that lost power has had its power restored. All of the lower-lying areas where Sharon is located, the southeast of the state, are almost still without power and are expected to be for 2 weeks. Basically what folks are talking about here is that the problem with Entergy is that it is a highly centralized, fossil fuel-intensive electricity company. Coal, natural gas in particular, are its baselines. And that what needs to happen is a decentralized, community-based, renewable energy system where you've got power provided closer to the and within control of the consumer, that it can be separated out. So if you lose power up here, you still have power everywhere else. And that power is helping to mitigate the climate crisis, not contribute to it, through coal, natural gas.
An Alliance for Affordable Energy analysis compared New Orleans to the nation and Louisiana as a whole and found the city not only has excessively high durations and frequency of power outages, but that they're also unequal. Gentilly, New Orleans East, Lower Ninth Ward, neighborhoods which are majority people of color and low-income experience the greatest proportion of outages, demonstrating a clear form of environmental racism, the analysis says. New Orleans also has the second highest percentage percentage of household income spent on energy bills in the country. That reading from Antonia's National Geographic article. We want to thank you both for being with us. We'll continue to report on what's happened in the Gulf. Antonia Juhas, oil and energy investigative journalist. Sharon Levine, founder and director of Rise St. James in Louisiana, recipient of the 2021 Goldman Environmental Prize, known as the Green Nobel Peace Prize.
You know, in this country, we get very little reporting, really, about about how corona is affecting the African continent. What is it, how is corona actually reported on the African continent in America? You know, what is there anything reported about corona on that continent, or is it zero?
As the U.S. and other Western countries discuss the rollout of COVID vaccine boosters in Africa and other parts of the world, many millions are still waiting for their very first shot. COVID has killed 200,000 people across the African continent, where there are nearly 8 million confirmed cases. While South Africa is on track to have a majority vaccinated by the end of the year, for many other sub-Saharan countries, fewer than 3% of their populations have been vaccinated. Earlier today, William Brangham spoke with the head of Africa's CDC, Dr. John Nkengasong.
Dr. John Nkengasong, thank you so much for joining us. I wonder if you could briefly just give us a sense, continent-wide, how is the pandemic going in Africa right now?
Unfortunately, we are not winning the war against this pandemic in Africa. As we speak, at least 32 countries are going through a very severe third wave, and about four or five other countries are actually witnessing a fourth wave. And the background of this is that we have very limited vaccines that have been introduced on the continent. A population of 1.2 billion people have only seen about 3% of the population fully vaccinated, which is unfortunate. If we imagine that our goal was to at least vaccinate up to 60% of our population by next year. So I think it is a very unfortunate situation we are witnessing in Africa.
I would love to talk about the vaccines in just a moment. Before then, though, is it your sense that the Delta variant is the primary variant of the virus across Africa now?
It is. As we speak, over 30-something countries have now reported the Delta variant. And Africa is a continent of 55 member states. So it's, at least about 20 countries have not yet reported the Delta variant. But the speed at which the variant is evolving suggests naturally that in the next couple of weeks or months, it will become the predominant variant.
I know that testing is not as widespread across Africa as it is elsewhere. Do you share the concern that you might be possibly missing even more cases simply because you don't have good eyes on the ground?
Oh, we are absolutely missing cases. There's no doubt about that because of lack of broad testing as we would love to. And it's not because countries don't want to do testing. I think it's lack of really access to large-scale testing. And we have made significant progress if you compare to where we were last year. Last year, around April, as a continent of 1.2 billion people, we had just tested over under 300,000 people. So, but today we are way past that mark there. But testing has to be the cornerstone of the response on the continent, because if we did not test, we did not find.
On this vaccination front, the global, the COVAX effort and many Western nations say that they are doing everything they possibly can to try to increase production and get vaccines elsewhere into the world. But it sounds like you clearly don't believe that effort is happening fast enough.
Well, let's admit it. I mean, the spirit of COVAX and the principle were sound, and they were based on our need to cooperate and to express solidarity. The reality is that it has not translated into action where in Africa, where, as we speak, as I indicated earlier, just under 3% of our population of 1.2 billion people have been vaccinated. If you recall, when this COVAX was set up, it was very clear that we wanted to have a basket where vaccines will be dumped into, and the vaccines that are effective will be accessible at the same time to everyone in the world who needed the vaccine. But that is not what we are seeing today.
And certainly here in the United States and in other parts of Western Europe and in Israel, they're talking about introducing booster shots and giving booster shots, which could be hundreds of millions of third doses going to wealthier nations while you all are still waiting for so many of your first doses.
That is absolutely correct. My greatest concern with the concept of a booster is that I have not seen the science yet that justify that. For example, there are at least a couple of conditions that or scenarios that evidence to is a better word that I'm looking for. One is that we should be able to define that when vaccine protection actually wins to the point that somebody actually needs a booster. We haven't seen that level, that data. Second is that even if the immunity of that vaccine drops to a certain level in people that have received it, do you still get protection from disease or and hospitalization? If the answer is that you still get enough protection there, then you don't need urgently to get a booster.
And certainly within the U.S., the Pfizer and Moderna, which are two of the most commonly used vaccines here, the evidence, as you say, does seem to indicate that we are still getting good protection from hospitalization and death with those two vaccines, which seems to reinforce the point that you're making, that it is not that urgent for Western nations to be giving boosters when you compare it to continents, entire continents like Africa that are waiting.
No, absolutely. I think if we look at the United States and also look at Israel, I mean, Israel was one of those countries, that perhaps the first country, that vaccinated at least 60% to 70% of its population. But the beauty of the situation in Israel is that even though most people that have received the vaccine were infected, they were not hospitalized and they were not having severe illness there. So that is, so the situation in Israel teaches us two things. One is that by vaccinating your entire population and neglecting other parts of the world from being vaccinated, you are not safe because it will breed new variants and the variants will challenge even your own vaccines that you have received. I think that is one. So lesson number two is that vaccines do, of course, those vaccines protect from disease, and but they do not protect from infection. So I think that is just very, very clearly messages that we should be taking home there, and that we truly don't know when, if we need a second dose and how soon we need that, the booster dose and how soon we need it.
All right, Dr. John Nkengasong, Director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, thank you so much for your time and best of luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your program.
Should he stay or should he go? That's the big question facing California's 22 million voters about their governor, Democrat Gavin Newsom, in the recall election next Tuesday. Vice President Kamala Harris, who previously served as a senator from the Golden State, was in Oakland today campaigning for Newsom, where she talked about the stakes for California and the rest of the country.
This recall campaign is about California, and it's about a whole lot more. They're thinking that if they can get this done in California, they can go around the country and do this. You got to understand what's happening right now. What's happening in Texas, what's happening in Georgia, what's happening around our country with these policies that are about attacking women's rights, reproductive rights, voting rights, workers' rights. They think if they can win in California, they can do this anywhere. Well, we will show them you're not going to get this done, not here, never.
To explain what is at stake for Newsom and the 46 candidates vying to replace him, we turn to Scott Schaefer. He is the politics and government editor for public media station KQED in San Francisco. He also hosts the Political Breakdown podcast. Scott Schaefer, welcome back to the NewsHour. So first off, what did Governor Newsom do to get what? How did he get himself in this situation where he invited this recall effort?
Well, Judy, we should say, first of all, this is the sixth recall effort against Gavin Newsom. In California, we have recall petitions circulating literally all the time. The first five petered out and went away. This one was about to have the same fate, but then a judge gave them another 120 days. And then the governor ate dinner at a posh restaurant in Napa Valley, was videotaped not wearing a mask at a time when he was telling everyone else to be home. And so that was a very simple idea, the idea of hypocrisy. And there was a lot of anger in the state as there was around the country. Schools were closed, businesses were closing, a lot of people were unemployed, people were scared, there was no vaccine. And I think a lot of people took it out on the governor, fairly or not, and signed the recall petition. And ultimately, more than 1.6 million voters signed it.
So it's a two-step process. People vote on the recall, and then they would vote, of course, on the replacement. But as we mentioned, 46 candidates, Scott Schaefer, that's a lot. But we know a couple of them have gotten most of the attention. Tell us about who they are.
Well, the one who is by far in the lead in every single poll is Larry Elder, conservative talk show host, African-American, lives in Los Angeles, and has gotten a lot of attention. He has a big media following. He also has a big social media following. And so he's been able to parlay that into a lot of support from his followers, as well as contributions. He's raised quite a bit of money, far more than the other candidates. And a lot of people had never really heard of him until he jumped into the race kind of at the last minute. Kevin Faulkner, the former moderate Republican mayor of San Diego, also in the race. He's, you know, trying to tack a little bit more to the center. He, when President Trump was in office, he opposed a lot of his policies along the border, like the border wall. Also running, we have John Cox, a businessman who ran against Gavin Newsom 4 years ago and actually was crushed by Newsom, 62 to 38%. He's running again. We also have Caitlyn Jenner. And there's one Democrat, Kevin Paffrath, a 29-year-old YouTube entrepreneur who has also a big social media following. The one kind of candidate who is not running, Judy, is an Arnold Schwarzenegger. There is no candidate who towers above the rest of the field and is able to attract moderate Democrats and independent voters. You know, Larry Elder is very good at getting the Republican base excited, but there's no indication that he can go beyond that.
So how is Gavin Newsom countering this? How is, what is his message coming back? And where does the race seem to stand right now?
At this point, it's sort of a blame versus fear. The Republicans are blaming Newsom for everything from crime to homelessness and the pandemic. And then you've got fear being talked about by Newsom, the fear of Larry Elder becoming governor of this state. Larry Elder has talked about rolling back policies on COVID, mask mandates, vaccine mandates, that kind of thing. And, you know, as we just heard in that segment from Idaho, you know, we don't have those kinds of problems the way Idaho does or Texas or Florida. And Newsom is saying, look, if you, this is me or Larry Elder. And that's really, based on the polls, fair to say. And so it's really, it's in some ways Christmas in September for Gavin Newsom, because Larry Elder has said some very outlandish things about slavery and reparations and women in the workplace. And it's coming back to haunt him and the Republican Party in a way, because he is now, whether they like it or not, their standard bearer. Polls show, at least the ones that I think are credible, show that Newsom is well ahead. In other words, the recall is only getting about 39% support. But it's all about who votes, Judy. It's right. All about the likely voters. And so that's what the Kamala Harris being here today, Biden being here next week. It's about turning out Democrats.
So just quickly, the question is, are voters paying attention? And can Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, make a difference in this race?
Well, at this point, there's no persuasion that needs to be done. Very few people are undecided. It's really about getting attention, reminding people that they got a ballot in the mail 3 weeks ago. You know, 22 million ballots went out. So that's really what it's about right now, is getting people to mail in or walk in that ballot. And if that happens, if there's a big turnout, and indications are there will be, Gavin Newsom should be okay, but it's by no means certain. And that's why he's really, you know, pulling out the stops to get people to vote.
KQED Scott Schaefer with a big story on his hands. Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Judy.
Seen four planes kill every- every day, folks. I guess 911 ain't no joke. Wall Street crying broke. Was it God or the devil who spoke? Old vampires in the new empire had the sky cooking. Brooklyn had no other choice but to stay and keep looking. City smile missing two front teeth while some of y'all still talk about beef.
Osama bin Laden is just one person. He is representative of networks of people who absolutely have made their cause to defeat the freedoms that we take that we understand, and we will not allow him to do so. I want him help. I want justice. And there's an old poster out west, as I recall, that said, "Wanted, dead or alive."
Tomorrow marks 20 years since the 9/11 attacks, and we're reflecting on the many things that have shifted lives since then. That includes a reshaped civil rights landscape for Arab, South Asian, and Muslim communities targeted by massive surveillance programs in the U.S. Here's one example. Asad Dandia. He's a lifelong Brooklynite, born to working-class Pakistani immigrant parents. And as a college student, he started a charity. It was called Muslims Giving Back, and it delivered groceries to neighbors in need. Now, in March of 2012, he received a Facebook message from a young man who said he wanted to become a better Muslim. So he asked to join the group.
And he grew very close to me in particular. He slept over my place, met my parents, had many, many intimate conversations with me about, you know, personal, emotional, intellectual, spiritual development. We prayed together. We shed tears together.
But a few months later, Asad's new friend made a disturbing social media post.
He eventually publicly confessed to being an informant for the NYPD who was sent to investigate terrorism, in his own words. And to see him come out and confess that it was all a facade was a major betrayal for me. It really hurt me. It really caused me to almost go into a spiral of trauma.
The revelation shook the community.
Many of our local Brooklyn neighborhoods kind of just went into their own silos. I was asked to stop raising money for our groceries at my local mosque, and donations plummeted. People, you know, in many ways distanced themselves from me, and I felt very guilty because I was the one who brought him into the community.
And he later joined a lawsuit challenging the surveillance of New York's Muslim communities. It resulted in a settlement and changes to NYPD's monitoring practices.
The experience of surveillance was, of course, terrifying in its initial sort of hit, but it's also been very empowering in the sense that it gave me the strength to endure.
Asad's case is one of many followed very closely by the Council on American Islamic Relations. Ahmed Mohammed is the legal director at their New York office. And to better understand how these programs have evolved and their impact, I spoke to him about the surveillance that existed before 2001 and how it shifted after 9/11.
Yeah, those programs were expanded exponentially. The government was tracking, surveilling, and looking after Muslims of every background all over the country. And that really started right after 9/11 with the passage of the Patriot Act, which then led to the Bush administration starting what was in essence a Muslim registry called the Nassar system, which was a national registry where Muslim males of the age of 18 to 25 were required to register with the federal government. That program lasted for 10 years. And, you know, that resulted in tracking, surveilling, interrogations, and deportations of many innocent Muslim men who had absolutely no connection whatsoever with terrorism or, you know, the tragic, horrific attacks of 9/11.
How did surveillance evolve from the early years of the Bush administration, from the kind of programs you're talking about, to the Obama years?
They were expanded. The Obama administration ended the Nassar system, but they created new programs like CVE, which was Countering Violent Extremism, which was dedicated to recruiting community leaders to assist on identifying youth who the government said were at risk for radicalization and terrorism. And it created a real distrust in the community where, you know, youth who might be mentally disturbed or troubled or going through a difficult time at home really had their safety net pulled from under them because they couldn't go to anybody because everybody was associated with law enforcement. they were investigating these individuals, sending in undercover agents, and causing the radicalization that they were supposedly there to try to stop.
I want to focus on New York City's program for a moment, because you've described it as the most sophisticated and robust of any local program. What kind of person did the NYPD recruit for their informants?
The NYPD recruited individuals who could go into mosques unnoticed and pretend to be Muslim, or individuals who were vulnerable Muslims. For example, individuals who maybe were out of status with their immigration, or Muslims who had committed minor offenses. And the NYPD, you know, used those opportunities to pressure and to force individuals to become confidential informants. And a lot of times they recruited those individuals based on arrests. They went so far, it was so sophisticated, that they created a demographics unit within the NYPD whose sole purpose was to map every Muslim that not only was in New York City at the time, but wherever they went within a 100 to 150 mile radius.
The federal program and the NYPD, they still carry out these efforts even after lawsuits. Can you talk about how the lawsuits affected things?
So the lawsuits, number one, educated the public on what was going on at the NYPD and how they were surveilling Muslims at such a systemic and everyday level. One that, you know, ordinary Americans probably didn't believe. Even Muslims themselves sometimes didn't believe it. The other thing that the lawsuits did was it created some minor reforms to prohibit the NYPD from investigating on the sole basis of religious activity. But that didn't stop surveillance, right? They have programs to scan your social media feeds. They have cameras at every corner that have facial recognition. You know, they have ways to hack into your phone, into your laptop. So the human asset that they were so dependent on for 15 years, they're less reliant on those.
What has been the response to those who say, look, fundamentally, these programs did either deter potential attacks, deter potential kind of radical actors, or that they somehow were able to do the work of preventing further terrorism?
Well, look, the NYPD themselves have stated on the record that this 15-year program of mapping and surveilling Muslims resulted in zero leads related to terrorism. It was a complete failure. And the reason for that is that Muslims are not engaged in this type of activity. They are everyday individuals, just like everyone else in this country, trying to get by, you know, feed their families at the end of the day, and make sure that, you know, they're able to have a good quality of life.
Ahmed Mohammed, legal director at the Council on American Islamic Relations office in New York. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And we reached out to the NYPD. They say the settlements reached in several lawsuits show a commitment to keeping the city safe while also safeguarding constitutional rights. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas says the former Countering Violent Extremism program has shifted its model to overcome issues of trust and to better empower local communities to identify potential terror threats.
The man, race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
Of Glynn County, our first look at the mugshot after former district attorney Jackie Johnson was booked into jail earlier today. She was being held on a $10,000 bond, but released on her own recognizance. That means she didn't have to pay anything. Johnson was indicted last week on multiple charges, including one count of violating her oath of office by allegedly showing favoritism to one of the suspects now charged in the murder of Ahmaud Arbery.
The indictment of a former Georgia district attorney has some calling for a review of other cases handed by Jackie Johnson. As On Your Side's Tristan Hardy reports from Glynn County tonight, that includes supporters of a controversial convicted pastor currently serving life in prison.
At the Glynn County Courthouse, Ahmaud Arbery's family says his case has had a history of troubled prosecutors.
Barnhill, Jackie Johnson, I want to see them two handcuffs. It got to be cleaned up.
Amen.
Time out. Amen. Let's clean all this mess up.
After the indictment of former Brunswick District Attorney Jackie Johnson, the Reverend Pharrell Malone and the Aubrey family want to see a broader investigation of her office.
Their errors caused us a lifetime of pain. We got to deal with this the rest of our lives.
Malone wants the Georgia Attorney General to take a look at every case, starting with Pastor Kenneth Atkins. Atkins was convicted in 2017 of 8 child molestation charges. Malone contends he was wrongfully convicted.
The timeline that Jackie Johnson's office put together was a lie.
Malone says the death of Ahmaud Arbery exposed Johnson's misconduct, but says there are other cases.
There are some brothers and sisters in jail right now who should be free.
Johnson has not yet entered a plea. In Glynn County, Tristan Hardy, First Coast News, on your side.
Tristan, thank you so much for that update.
It's the sport of kings, better than diamond rings. Football.
Wildcats.
Football.
Wildcats.
Football.
Wildcats.
Football.
Wildcats.
Football.
Well, administrators denied a request for audio, video, and written transcripts of the Student Code of Conduct hearings, but UK did provide its investigation report, and that included accounts from interviews the Office of Student Conduct held with witnesses and suspects. Now, all of the documents are heavily redacted because of federal privacy laws for universities, and that makes it hard to connect some of the dots, but they do provide a clearer picture of what everyone involved says happened that night.
Football players told UK officials they had hung out several times before at this home in a popular off-campus student housing area when on the night of Saturday, March 6th, they decided to go to a frat party there. An August news release from Lexington police announcing charges stated they entered uninvited, got upset when asked to leave, and threatened to come back, later forcing their way into the home. Offensive lineman R.J. Adams, running back Jatan McClain, defensive back Andrew Phillips, wide receiver Ernest Sanders IV, safety Vito Tisdale, and defensive back Joel Williams have all been charged with first-degree burglary. Accounts included in UK's student conduct report state when the first group showed up after midnight, they were greeted with racial slurs from an unidentified girl in a blue jersey. Later, when a larger group arrived, someone outside warned partygoers inside to lock the door. Then the accounts state a number of guys swarmed the house through the back door. While the group inside tried to barricade the front door to keep others from pushing in too. Several people were reportedly injured in the altercation that followed, including multiple women saying they got punched, one saying she was pushed against the wall by her neck. A student conduct hearing board found at least 8 students responsible for either harm and threat of harm or for failure to follow COVID-19 guidelines. Notes show that members of the hearing board agreed, quote, that alcohol and the use of racial slurs played a significant role and caused the escalation of those events, end quote. The fraternity that threw the party, Alpha Sigma Phi, was given 1 year of disciplinary probation for various violations, a UK spokesperson told the Herald Leader.
You know, I have to respect the system, and I do.
The UK football players involved were pulled out of practice for weeks until administrators cleared their case. They were allowed back on the field, but then were pulled out again when charges were filed as coach Mark Stoops waited to learn more.
I just know what's been done to our players. I'm not sure what's been done to others.
All 6 UK players facing criminal charges have pleaded not guilty. A preliminary hearing was waived to the grand jury. In a letter from April sent to the student responsibility coordinator, one of the football players denied the allegations against him, adding, quote, I was the victim of a hate crime that I will be following up and filing charges with the city of Lexington soon. This was a very traumatic experience for me, something I never had to endure in my lifetime.
In addition to burglary, Vito Tisdale is also charged with wanton endangerment. He's accused of pointing a handgun at someone. Now, in the records from the Office of Student Conduct's investigation, notes show the hearing board could not say with certainty he had a gun. That's according to unredacted reports family members shared with the Courier-Journal. A GoFundMe to pay legal fees for the 6 UK football players facing charges has raised more than $21,000. At the Alert Desk, Garrett Weimer, WKYT.
As your body grows bigger,
your mind must flower. It's great to learn,
cause knowledge is power.
It's Schoolhouse Rockin', the chip off the block, on your favorite Schoolhouse.
A lot of people are eager for K through 12 schools to get back to normal. But a group of parents in Oakland, California say normal wasn't cutting it for their children. Now, thanks in part to the upheaval of the pandemic, school officials are starting to listen. Vanessa Roncagno from member station KQED reports.
There are only two students in Irene Segura's online class.
I'm going to tell you to say a word, and then I want you to sound it out.
It's late spring, and first graders Ashley Preciado Miguel and Ambria Taylor already had a full day of distance learning. They meet with Segura in the evening, 2 days a week, to work on their reading.
Here we go. Say mute.
Mute.
What's the first sound? Mute.
The intensive literacy course is part of a program the parent advocacy group Oakland Reach launched during the pandemic.
It's created by parents for parents.
Oakland Reach co-founder Lakeisha Young.
Immediately when COVID hit, you heard so many people saying like, oh my God, it's just going to get worse for Black and brown kids. It's just going to get worse. And well, then what are you going to do about it?
The program is designed to respond to the needs of students who've had the fewest opportunities. Oakland schools have a history of segregation, and that continues today. Students of color are more likely to attend under-resourced schools, and those schools are more likely to report lower reading levels for Black and Latino students.
Less than 30% of our kids read on grade level, so we have no interest in continuing the learning that our children are getting.
For years, Oakland Reach has been demanding the district do better. Now, thanks in part to the pandemic, the two groups are working together in a whole new way, bringing Oakland Reach's program to 6 elementary schools this fall.
The brilliance of this moment is we all had to stretch and do something different out of necessity.
That's Oakland Unified Superintendent Kyla Johnson-Trammell at a national education conference in May. Johnson-Trammell has acknowledged that the district has to do more to get kids reading at grade level and to prepare them for college.
It comes down to taking some risk. It comes down to pointing people back to, do you really think where we are now is good enough?
If the answer is no, she said, then it's time to do things differently. That's where Oakland Reach comes in. In addition to intensive reading classes, Reach offers the kind of enrichment activities that more affluent families might take for granted. There's art, science, music, cooking, and tutoring, plus support for parents.
It is the educational utopia that our families have always wanted, the quality that they wanted.
That's Lakeisha Young again. Johnson-Trammell admitted that teaming up hasn't always been easy.
There have been many touchy, uncomfortable conversations that Lakeisha and I have had in terms of this isn't working, but to me, that is the work.
Parent Leonard Taylor is glad to hear the district is working with Oakland Reach. He says Reach has already made a difference for his daughter, Ambria, one of the students in that intensive literacy class. She was falling behind in distance learning. Now?
Actually, she's above her reading level. I feel better now because she's in tune. She show interest, you know. She don't even want to go to her regular school class, the Oakland Reach program. She's ready.
Though the new partnership is starting small, Lakeisha Young says the goal is to enroll another 500 students this fall. She wants to help district leaders expand the program and eventually hand it over to them completely. For NPR News, I'm Vanessa Rancagno in Oakland.
White supremacy is the sickness.
It's been viewed more than 1 million times.
You guys, they can't touch you. Just go ahead and go in.
Video showing parents in Washtenaw County urging their kids to ignore their high school's mask mandate and enter the school.
Mob mentality rules. I mean, it's just unfortunate.
Good to have you with us tonight at 11. It happened at Manchester High School, about 20 miles southwest of Ann Arbor.
This came after a new county order, and as Jason Colthorpe reports, the viral video has drawn swift reaction from the district, police, and now the governor.
The first thing you need to understand about this district is masks were originally optional for students, but then Washtenaw County issued its emergency health order, which basically superseded the district, and all students were required to wear masks. But Tuesday morning, some parents and their students clearly were not ready to abide by the new rules.
Don't want to go in? You don't have to.
After confirming police will not stop them.
I'm not going to force anybody. I'm not putting masks on anybody. That's not my job.
Manchester High parents encourage their kids to ignore the staff at the door and go inside without masks.
You guys, they can't touch you. Just go ahead and go in.
Finally, the students are allowed in.
And after some unintended irony,
be kind and respectful,
they were taken to the library, apart from everyone else.
It's absolutely insane.
This Manchester parent believes in masking up, but thinks it should be everyone's choice. The insanity isn't the mob mentality, as he says in the video, but the hypocrisy of the health department.
They have no problem allowing 110,000 people in the big house to scream and yell and breathe all over each other, and that's no big deal, but you have 300 kids in a school and all of a sudden it's a big deal.
The governor telling me today she hadn't seen the video, but it would not sway her to order a mask mandate. Just this message to parents.
We ask that parents afford teachers and those who are on the front lines some grace and support masking up. It's the best thing for their students and it's the best thing for our ability to recover from the academic disruption that COVID's created.
And 24 hours after this video, the superintendent says it was a much different scene.
After sending out communications last night, our students came in peacefully with masks on. Manchester has always been a place that's come together around things, and hopefully after some struggles that we can do that again, because that's been a hallmark of our community for a long time.
Jason, just curious, we heard the deputy in the beginning of the video. I'm assuming he was following policy there when he was saying, you know, I'm not going to make you put on a mask. I'm not going to, you know, do anything.
Yeah, he was, Kim. And we did get some further clarification from the sheriff's department about exactly what they do in these situations. And I want to read it to you. They said law enforcement is there to keep the peace, help keep people calm, to de-escalate situations, to explain and to advise. We're not there to cite people for a public health violation. It can become a legal enforceable action if things get out of hand and some other enforceable action is needed, like an assault or destruction of property. But what has been working for us most of the time is explaining to community members and making sure they understand what the public health order is and what can happen. And that stance certainly paid off yesterday morning. And judging by the kids coming in and wearing their masks today, everything was good today, but we'll have to see, obviously, how it goes going forward.
Yeah, Kim? Indeed. We'll continue to follow it. Jason, thanks.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Damn you, Obama.
NBC2 News at 5.
I have been crystal clear. Our kids will be safe. This could have been the next Parkland massacre.
A tip to a teacher, a map of a middle school and weapons leads to the arrest of two Lee County students accused of planning to carry out a mass shooting. This is brand new video from inside one of those teens' homes. Thanks for counting on NBC2. I'm Kelly Burns.
And I'm Peter Bush. Investigators say those two students were obsessed with the Columbine school shooting and plan to replicate it at Harns Marsh Middle School in Lehigh Acres. NBC2 has team coverage tonight as we work to get you answers to all your questions. Megan Myers is at the school right now getting reaction from parents. But we begin with NBC2's Christy Soto live from the Lee County Sheriff's Office.
The sheriff says they were able to quickly put a stop to this mass shooting plot after a teacher at Harns Marsh Middle School came forward. And now we can show you what deputies found inside the boys' homes.
We are 1 second away from a Columbine here.
Sheriff Carmine Marcino says 13-year-old Connor Pruitt and 14-year-old Philip Byrd were planning a mass shooting at Harns Marsh Middle School. But thanks to information from a teacher, deputies were able to stop them. Yesterday, a teacher got word an eighth grade student had a gun. When deputies searched the backpack, they found a map of the school with security cameras circled. Deputies went to Pruitt and Byrd's homes today off Oakfield Avenue South and Willard Avenue in Lehigh. That's where they found guns and knives and a poster of bullets on one teen's wall.
Detectives learned the students took an interest in the Columbine High School shooting. They were extensively studying to learn more about the incident and the shooters.
In less than 24 hours, LCSO detectives prevented a massacre.
This could have been the next Parkland massacre, but we stopped them.
The two teens are charged with conspiracy to commit a mass shooting. The sheriff said the two teens are well known to the department, and deputies have been to their homes at least 80 times. Kelly?
Chrissy, I understand that deputies think that the teens were trying to make more weapons.
Yeah, Kelly, deputies say that the teens were trying to learn how to make pipe bombs, and they were also trying to learn how to purchase weapons in the black market. Live in Lee County, Chrissy Soto, NBC2.
Let's go now live to Harns Marsh Middle School. NBC2's Megan Myers has been speaking with parents and a student who saw deputies search the school today.
Well, parents that we spoke to who were picking up their students here at this middle school this afternoon were pretty shaken up. One man told us that he received two emails from the school district about the threat, and he says it made his heart sink when that popped up on his phone. Another mom told us that she was unaware that this even happened, but her son we spoke to saw investigators swarm the inside of the school today, and he says that now knowing the details of what happened, it's extremely uncomfortable.
When I was in second period in research in the library, there were deputies everywhere in the library taking down the books and stuff and searching through the storage rooms and stuff.
I'm very upset. I'm a nurse. I deal with stuff all the time, and now I have to worry about my kid going to school. Scary.
Now we are working to find out why exactly deputies have responded to the two teens' home around 80 times in the past. Of course, as we learn any new confirmed details on this, we'll be sure to update you throughout the night. I'm live in Lee County. Megan Myers, NBC2.
So, you know, these events that keep coming up, instead of just reacting, dealing with them one at a time and being shocked each time we have another event that surfaces that is brought to our attention, we need to function from the position of an analysis that clarifies we are in a total system structure of racism, white supremacy, and that is why we are seeing the kinds of behaviors from individuals, be it Donald Sterling or be it George Zimmerman or any of the other cases that come to our attention. There is a reason that these cases exist. And I want to also talk about, in this case, they talked about mental health, but also gun control. And we have to begin to understand, I say you can't understand the gun mania if you don't understand racism, white supremacy. The gun is the answer to conscious and or subconscious, the answer, the response to the quite collective feeling they can be genetically annihilated by black genetic material. And the gun is a great equalizer. I encourage everybody to get a copy of the ISIS papers and read.
If he'd given us the opportunity, we'd have shot him up a lot. But he didn't, because he was a coward.
Now at 6:30, Polk County Sheriff is fired up over a mass murder. Four people shot to death, including an infant who was being held in his mother's arms. The sheriff says a stranger has been arrested for the shootings who gave himself up when confronted.
You see, it's easy to shoot innocent children and babies and people in the middle of the night when you got the gun and they don't.
I'm Eric Von Eck, and glad you're with us tonight. This is a horrific story in our area that's already making headlines around the country. The sheriff there, Grady Judd, you just saw, says the man they arrested first fired shots at them and fired dozens, if not hundreds, of shots overall. This all started around 7:30 last night when a man in a suspicious car stopped outside the home on North Socrum Loop near Lake Gibson Middle School. This is in the Lakeland area. That's about 40 miles southwest of Kissimmee. The man said something to a woman living there and drove off. Deputies say that man, Brian Riley, came back around 4:30 this morning, killing people in two homes. News 6's Brian Didlake is following the latest developments for us. Brian, an 11-year-old girl was also shot.
Yes, that's correct, Aaron, and it's very unfortunate. And at this time, Lakeland police say that this whole ordeal was a very hard thing to get their heads wrapped around, as they say that they're going to have to take some time to get this together.
I will never be able to unsee that mother with that deceased infant in her arms.
Polk County Sheriff Grady Judd describing the scene in Lakeland after three people were found dead, including a mother, her three-month-old infant, and that infant's grandmother. An 11-year-old girl is also in the hospital after deputies found her with seven gunshot wounds. According to Polk County Sheriff's Office, 33-year-old Brian Riley is the man responsible for the shooting.
We just know we had a madman with a lot of guns that shot and killed innocent people.
Deputies say this all started as a suspicious vehicle call Saturday evening. It wasn't until early Sunday morning when one lieutenant says he heard.
And he hears two bursts of what he believes to be automatic gunfire.
Deputies rushed to the area, not at first knowing where to go, until they found a Lakeland home with Riley's car on fire and glow sticks surrounding the area. Officials say Riley, wearing camouflage and body armor, was waiting to ambush and exchange gunfire with deputies until he ran back into the home.
We heard another volley of shots, and that's when we heard the woman scream and the baby. And then we tried to enter, and that's when we had one of our volleys of gunfights with him and apparently shot him on that particular occasion.
Riley then gave himself up, but according to Sheriff Judd, Riley only suffered minor injuries due to him wearing body armor. During interrogation, he had only this to say.
He just explained that they begged for their life and that he shot and killed him anyway.
Riley is a decorated veteran serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. His girlfriend says he showed no signs of aggression but claims he suffered from PTSD. But Sheriff Judd says that's no excuse.
It's important to underscore, just because you have mental health problems does not mean you're not criminally liable. He's criminally liable. He played word games with us during the interviews to try to set a defense. That doesn't work.
And now investigators say there is another victim, Justice Gleason, who was mowing his lawn nearby before being killed by Riley. This whole ordeal is complicated, and officials say everything may be subject to change. We have the full details of what we have learned so far inside our website and mobile app. But for now, we're in the newsroom. Brian Dillick getting results, News 6.
So he played word games with them. Word games. Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, and for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, September 11, 2021. So I have been told. I don't know. Sometimes I feel like at one point today was a so-called holiday. They called it Patriots Day. Am I making that up? Did people see that? I feel like it was a so-called holiday at one point. At any rate, let me start by saying, before we do the number and all the, you know, proper introduction, my bad. That segment where the two teens, white teens in Florida, pipe bombs, we're going to do it up Columbine style, firearms, got all the security camera information. At the end of that segment, when they said that, oh, yeah, enforcement officers were familiar with this duo, they were well known. They'd been to their house about 80 times. That should have been a rewind. I mean, for Tamir Rice, for a whole lot of reasons. Michael Brown Jr. That should have been a rewind. My bad. Now, they did cover my deficiency because they did say it again, like in case you didn't hear it. If you thought we said eight times, maybe four piece doesn't sound so bad. No. That's not what we said. We said we are still trying to figure out. And even that, I think, is white supremacy racism. If that had been a black child accused of these type of crimes, You were plotting to massacre other children? White children? They would have read every infraction all the way down to, we think, you know, he spit out gum improperly when he was 3 years old. I mean, it would have been any and everything. He forgot to flush the toilet when he was two. Anything. I suspect we got a lot of folks who didn't even hear about that. I know when I tried to get information, when I found out about it yesterday, this happened Friday, the 10th, it kept going to Riley. The one that happened in Polk County. Now, that one, I said, oh, my gosh, I wasn't even going to play that because I wasn't focused on that. So many things happened down in Florida. Ron DeSantis land, my goodness, I am never going to Florida again. They have been cutting a fool, like, in every way imaginable. Maybe we should pray for retired firefighter and caller at the courthouse, all of the folks down in the Florida area, Kamisha M. Africa and other folks. You have family down there, you should pray for them. They are cutting a fool. Might be a metaphor. They are acting in a very reckless, erratic, dangerous manner in the state of Florida, worldwide. But I mean, wow, it seems really concentrated and dangerous in the Sunshine State. Governor all the way down. Ron DeSantis, 2024. But I wasn't even going to play the last segment. And I said, wait a minute, Polk County? Isn't that the caller at the courthouse? Let me get to that later. I'll do things properly. Context of white supremacy. This is the compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, views to share on some of the segments. So many things happened this week. Whatever else has been going on related to white supremacy, racism. The number to dial is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61. If you would like to participate. Polk County, Florida. I am never going there. I have to find that picture I took from the retreat. The cracker, the Florida cracker. Indeed, they have been cracking all year long. Number again is 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. One thing I'll share. Man, it's like we have been visited 80 times or more by ATF or FBI, Homeland Security. Woo! One of our listeners asked, like, man, where's B? You know? Miss hearing from her. Is she safe? She doing all right? I was able to speak with her to confirm, yes, she is safe. She was very thankful for listeners checking in on her. Wow, it has been a doozy worldwide. She was just talking about all of the craziness in Canada, and they're talking about vaccine passports. They were protesting about that. Lots of white people, you can't travel if you don't have proof of vaccination and all these other things, and then people not taking it serious. I think she said some people had developed a really nihilistic attitude about all this, meaning kind of, oh, well, if I, you know, get the Rona and die, oh, well, that's, just, you know, all the time I was meant to have, but I'm not doing the mask and all that other stuff. I'm not even distancing. You want a high five right now? That attitude was, that was spreading. The Rona was spreading. Vaccine passports, like, no fun north of the border. But she did greatly appreciate the concern. And yes, she is alive, not well, but alive. Still system of racism, white supremacy, but as best things can be. The Cows listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. You can hit my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Address again, racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. We're also on Cash App at cash.app/$. The Cows. Enormous gratitude to all the folks who have invested any time over the past 12 plus years. Hopefully the Cows has been worthy of your life energy. Hopefully we also have provided accurate, constructive information more often than not about what white supremacy racism is, how it works, what it means to be white, Again, enormous thanks to all the folks who have invested, listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Other things to share before we get to some of the folks who dialed in. Since they're talking about 9/11 and the Patriot Act, I can only say again, I believe, I'll have to double-check to make sure, the so-called no-fly list, that also is connected to 9/11, meaning, hey, you know, you're suspicious, maybe of terrorist origins, not letting you on the plane. All of those anti-maskers, we're going to get on the plane and we got, this is the moment we need to break dance and boogaloo and I'm not doing a mask and all the rest of, no-fly list. Why do you have a no-fly list if you're not going to use it? Anywho, with all the 911 and reminiscing about what we were doing, the good old days, how to explain this to offspring, I would start with number one, racism, white supremacy is the master form of terrorism on the planet, period. Now, all the rest of it now, you can just do a great lesson in terms of words. I did see one or two reports talking about that this week in terms of when do we use the word terrorism? Are these teenagers down in Florida, pipe bombs, and we're going to do Columbine? Are they terrorists? Dylan Roof, is he a terrorist? Do you have to be a non-white person to be a terrorist? That would be a major part of the lesson. Exactly when do we employ this word terrorism and when do we decide not to use that word? At any rate, and the creation of Homeland Security is so many components of white supremacy racism. It was a totally different world to try to fly before 9/11. You didn't have all that. You had to take off your shoes and be groped and fondled by 50,000 people before you could get on a plane. It was a totally different world before 9/11. Something definitely to explain to offspring in the context of white supremacy racism. One that I can share, the cows did not exist in 2001, 9/11, and I was super confused, hadn't, you know, read about or researched Mr. Fuller's work at that time or Dr. Welsing's work, super, super, super confused victim of racism. Watching television, not reading, so I get up the morning of 9/11, I'm in Virginia at this point, I wake up, it's 8:59, I literally am watching a different world, I kid you not, like, what is it, Kadeem Hardison, right? Jasmine guy, I am literally watching a different world, Sinbad and all, on the USA Network, no less. A different world goes off at 9 a.m. I turn the television off, go take a shower, get ready to go to work. I get to work, literally, people are running around in the parking lot. I'd been listening to my own music in the vehicle, and it was a short ride anyway, so I get to work 10-something. People are literally, we're in Virginia, so we could have driven to watch the Pentagon hit and all that. We could have driven up there. We would have been there by, I don't know. If I went to work, we got there at 10, we could have been there by 1 or somewhere in that region. We'd have been there that afternoon. I guess we would have missed the hit, but we could have went and watched the cleanup or whatever and took photographs. So not too far away from D.C. People are literally running around in the parking lot. And, oh, my God, Werner. I just remember like, what? What is going on? Like, what are you all talking about? It was so crazy. Like, I think I might have been the only person there totally clueless about what are you talking about? What? What is going on? Are you sure? Like, are you lying? Like, it was so crazy. And then, because I was at work, they didn't, like, cancel work or anything like that. I had to go to court. Like, it was a work day. So, like, I do not, like, of all the people, like, sitting around and talking about what they saw and watching the towers come down and all the rest of it, I do not have that memory at all. In fact, I don't think I got in front of a television until, I think it might have actually been the next day. Or no, it was late. It was very, very late in the day. Like, everything had happened and all the rest of it. I think it was probably sometime after 7 p.m. Eastern. I do not have that memory at all. Maybe there would be no cows if I had sat there and watched all that. Because, I mean, wow, the jingoism and patriotism was out of this world for about the next 6 months. I think the Patriots won the Super Bowl that season. The legend of Tom Brady was right there. the Patriot Act, and the Patriots won the Super Bowl. Maybe that's just goofy, but that did happen. Anywho, different world. Kadeem Hardison. Let's see. Next. I was almost ran over today. I was in Capitol Hill. I went to get my dinner. Yummy coconut brown rice. Love coconut brown rice. Organic bananas. Getting my yummy little snacks together. And I'm coming back. Go to cross the intersection at Olive and 15th. I can be specific about where I was. Now, there's no crosswalk, but because we just had the program right away, Angie Schmidt, she says in the book, every intersection is a natural, lawful crosswalk, whether it's painted, signs posted, or not. Every intersection is a legal crosswalk for pedestrians, and this is a super residential area. I just gave you the cross streets, 15th and Olive. There is a school about four blocks from this intersection. There's a senior facility maybe three blocks from this intersection, a grocery store maybe two blocks from that intersection. Like, it is a super residential area. I think the speed limit is 20 miles an hour. Black motorists, like, growls at me, get across the street. In fact, I think it was both the black motorist and everyone in the vehicle. And I just looked at them like, what? Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter. We have been brain trashed, all of us. And a lot of us, I think, have been brain trashed, or we have been taught to drive the same way that white people do, and having a lack of regard for black life. And that's actually the second time I was in the crosswalk and had a black motorist nearly run me down. The other time, they actually had the little flashing white man and everything, like, totally painted crosswalk. And he waved. Oh, sorry, black brother. My bad. Black Lives Matter. Unsafe being a black pedestrian, even in Seattle. Lots of bike lanes and crosswalks. Next. The segment on NPR where they talked about Hurricane Ida and the black civilians of Louisiana who went to the plantation for shelter. I said, number one, where else but the context of white supremacy? We heard that before. Hurricane, like, once in a lifetime apocalyptic hurricane comes to devastate Louisiana and there's no refuge. Where can we go? The slave plantation. Yes, we already heard that. Context of white supremacy. Gary Rivlin, how he starts his book, Katrina, after the flood. So we were in the slave plantation on our way to cover Katrina. And second, now last week we heard Louis Armstrong. They have all of these historically preserved sites, you know, the foundation of jazz, Congo Square in New Orleans, and these places where Louis Armstrong worked, where he lived. These places are supposed to be monuments, you know? And they said, oh, I had to just knock some of those away. Dang. They said, we knew this was going to happen. Nobody's invested in upkeep and making sure that this place is rebuilt and preserved. That's not the case for the slave plantations. You heard, they bragging like, wow, look at how thick these walls are. Wow. Maintained, nicely painted. Wow. Built to withstand all kinds of hurricanes. What does that say? The airport in New Orleans is named after Louis Armstrong, and we can't even preserve his historic monuments and houses and things that are supposed to mean something for jazz, which the art form itself is supposed to be a national park. But that's not preserved. The slave plantation is preserved. Context of white supremacy. I don't say enslaved. Make it plain. Slave. Next. Florida, man. Both ways. In fact, before I even get to the situation in Florida, the report that we heard, since all of this is education, the segment where they talked about Oakland, California, and the black and brown, really, that is such an incorrect phrase, so-called brown people, whatever that, I mean, all of it is promoting incorrect thinking about this problem. Brown, I have no idea what that means, and individuals classified as black are treated way worse than everybody else. It is a total error to lump in black and brown, brown and black. Total error for many, many reasons, just promoting incorrect thinking about this problem. All of that said, in that segment, they spoke with Lakeisha Young, non-white female victim of racism, victims guaranteed qualified. She said, and I quote, immediately when COVID hit, you heard so many people. Now this, I suspect she's talking about non-white people because white people generally don't pout about the plight of non-white children or black children specifically. She says, when COVID hit, you heard so many people saying like, oh my gosh, it's going to get worse for black and brown kids. It's just going to get worse. And well, then what are you going to do about it? Now, that's great and all, but the reason that that caught my attention was that they did a lot of pussyfooting and being real indirect. Like, we can't just say white people practice racism and have done so in the area of education in Oakland and beyond for decades. Not we have segregation and the black children go to schools with less resources and are reading at lower levels where they're not on level. That none of that is indicting. Now, why is all of that the case? Are black students just dumb? Or are we just going to leave out that white people did this deliberately? Not even that you can't go to these schools, can't go to the library, might not even be able to come into this town, might not even be able to live in this state, Oregon. If we're going to be that mealy-mouthed, if you're not going to put some bass in your voice and come out and be that direct in acknowledging just truthfully what white people have done to produce all this, but then we can get loud and rowdy in how we critique other black people, non-white people, I do not support that at all. Talk to everybody the same way. If you're going to put some bass in your voice and be like, really, that should be directed at the culprits, the people who are to blame for all of this. Absolutely, it can be, yes, what are we going to do to solve this? But even that would have to be presented in the context. Now, there are many, many instances. Let's make sure we're not presenting this like the problem is black people are lazy and we just aren't invested in solving some of our own problems. That's happened a bunch of times. And the same thing, like with the context of white supremacy, you have lots of white sabotage where they come in to disrupt that and totally foil your efforts to help improve academics for black children. Make things plain. Let's see. I'll do Florida, and then I'll make sure I can finish what I was saying about B. In Canada. So the situations in Florida, plural, is so many things to pick from. Governor Ron DeSantis and multiple shootings, the children. Polk County, where this white fella goes and is killing all of these people, and they're saying that this is PTSD. Why not an act of terrorism? In my view, white genetic annihilation. I've been saying for at least a good month now, they've been having many, many reports all over the world. White people are not, or the percentages, or sometimes they'll say the actual population of white people is declining in this part of the world. This part of the world and even Europe, they'll include sometimes. Emphasizing that within all of the other stress with COVID-19 and the hurricanes and floods and wildfires and everything else that has been taking place, I suspect you will have lots of individuals classified as white who are behaving in a very erratic, reckless, violent manner. I've been saying that. That's been a part of why I've been saying be cautious when you go out, be alert because of these type of events. But why in Polk County? And even did you hear what the arresting officer said? They said when they went to go get him, horrendous. He's killed children and shot this 11-year-old and all that. Totally, barbarous, savage. But I mean, hey, he's a decorated Marine. I thought that was important, too. Now, I think of decorations as like a party or something festive. These decorations for folks in the armed services generally are associated with killing. Generally, I mean, you might get a Purple Heart or something like that if you get injured in battle or you save somebody. But I mean, generally, these decorations are a symbol for you killed some folks. Probably not just one person, like generally a whole lot of folks, probably non-white people. But what did George Bush, George W. Bush. What did he say? He said, dead or alive. Reminiscent about the good old days. But what that sort of conduct, and I said, man, that's the caller at the courthouse, I think. Isn't he in Polk County? He can tell us maybe. I said, my goodness, I wasn't even going to play that segment. I said, Polk County, where have we heard that before? He just told us that they had a white man who went and total horror film Jason Voorhees, Michael Myers, butcher knife, and slit some white person's throat. Trail of blood and everything. Marvin Gaye said, what is going on? White genetic annihilation and lots of erratic, violent, dangerous behavior. Be alert. Now, even with the 13-year-olds, we can stay in the same state. I put it in the form of a question. How many of you all at 13 could access a firearm, plans for pipe bombs, and or schematics for the security cameras at your school? How many of you all think you could get those sorts of materials at 13? Pause for Tamir Rice, who couldn't even get past toy gun stage before he was apprehended fatally. Michael Brown Jr. walking in the street. That was the reason that he was stopped by the race soldier, not the strong armed robbery. Those weren't connected. It was he was walking in the street. How many of you all think you could get plans for making pipe bombs at 13? Feel like President Obama lied to me, man. I don't see a change in behavior among younger white people, but maybe I haven't been exposed to the correct ones yet. Anywho, for the broadcast, if we could not use metaphors, race soldiers will regularly employ similes and comparisons. Sometimes they'll take two entities that are completely separate and suggest that they are identical, exactly the same. Frequently, that is a lie. Victims, non-white people, we have been exposed to this misconduct for decades, longer than that. And we are still learning, many of us. So sometimes we don't have logic to articulate our views, and we'll substitute some sort of metaphor or comparison. If we could make an effort for this broadcast specifically to be precise, exact, specific with what we want to say, that would be great. I think it's also very constructive to get in the habit of being very selective with our words. The mechanics of counter-racism. Words are important. They said Mr. Ryan down in Florida, Polk County, said he's playing word games with us. Racist man, racist woman, and racist child play a lot of word games. Anywho, number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your thoughts, observations, questions, or suggestions, that would be great. Make sure that everybody has at least one opportunity to share. Let's see. First few folks who dialed in will get to their hands. I'll make sure also to finish B in Toronto, her commentary. Good to hear from her. She, again, she appreciated everyone's thoughts and well wishes. Let's see. Our caller, I guess, in Georgia should be with us, or take that back. 9086 should be with us, and then I'll nab other hands as I see them.
Hey, caller from the 712 here. I just wanted to talk about that access. I was glad you said that, the access to guns. Now, where I live here, they made it to where you don't even have to really register anything. They signed that in. I think it went in to law last month. And so just making it more accessible
trying to think to where the white mindset would be on that, because they have, I mean, they have access to guns anyway. So me and my family was just discussing that, like, you made it even more accessible. Maybe something's going to happen to where they know they need more guns, even more, to get more guns even easier. So everybody just stay safe out there. I mean, that one guy that went and shot that family, he had over 100 rounds, they said. So everybody be safe out there. And, you know, I'm always thinking about you. Thank you for letting me speak.
Absolutely. If anything, keep that in mind. That's what I've been saying, I guess, for nearly 2 years. Man, if you go out and somebody is being rowdy and hostile, it could be Mr. Riley. It could be those teens in Florida, pipe bombs and everything. Like, if you didn't leave your residence prepared to kill and or die, like, I don't care what you got, pipe bomb, whatever. You all have picked the wrong Negro to mess with. Like, unless that is your level of codification, exit. Like, somebody is being hostile and rowdy, you should be thinking, like, wow, this fella, this gal might be armed. I'm going to get distance. Evacuate. That was the last E in Alice. I remember that one. Evacuate. Especially keeping in mind how unhinged, reckless so many people have been over this year. Also, I just wanted to state, since we were talking about education, the children in Florida, not white children in Florida, excuse me, that was in Wisconsin, not wearing the mask. Wisconsin, Michigan, one of those Midwest states, not wearing masks in school, and the officer calmly talking to the children and all of that. I think that scene would have been very different if that had been Tamir Rice, Tina Rice, going to school, we're not going to wear masks. I think it would have been a very different scene. In fact, here in Seattle, I've been at a cafe where the only person that I've seen, like, shoot out of a facility was a black child who did not have a mask on. Maybe that's just a coincidental anecdote. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, *61. If you have commentary, proceed.
Hello.
That is our caller in Georgia. I was confused. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Good evening, everyone. I hope everyone's having the best evening that they can have. I just, you know, good, you know, very constructive clips, as always. No, I don't, never had access to any firearms. I still don't. I mean, I guess I can go buy some, but no access to firearms. I mean, I had a squirt gun once, but I don't think that counts. Not even a super, but whatever. The education, especially the literacy, that is very important. And I looked it up, because I think, I don't know if we talked about it before, but I remember reading people in Detroit, they had sued a federal suit about literacy, and the regular judge, that first level judge, was like, the children don't have a right to learn how to read in school. But, and recently I looked it up, I guess in 2020, they appealed, of course, and the appellate court judge in that area, because if you don't know about those courts, they are divided in certain areas, was like, well, if they don't know how to read, how can they participate in America with voting and things like that? So they reversed that first level judge district. That's what they called district, then appealed and Supreme. So those are things you have to look into. And of course, the appellate court is only for a certain area. And so learning how to read, we think, oh, we send our children to learn how to read. Nope, not a right. So if you do have children, you plan to have children, plan to be around children, you know, you want to be aware of their literacy, and not just literacy in general, being able to read certain things. Again, helping people with their taxes. People don't know how to read. their tax, if they get a tax notice, they don't know how to follow the instructions. Because while you may use a TurboTax or HR block or something like that, you are legally responsible for those taxes. And it doesn't matter what age you are. If you are a cute little baby and your parents put you in a bunch of baby commercials and you make adult money, you're going to get an adult bill. I don't care if you're only 2 months old. No one cares. They don't care. There's no age for taxes. So, again, at that point, your parents are responsible because you were 2 months old, but, you know, someone has to pay those. So, again, not just learning how to read in general. Yes, you do, but learning how to read certain documents that will help you throughout your life. Like, you need to learn how to read contracts. You know, the SAT, you know, when you take SATs and things like that, that's why they have those special courses, because you have to kind of learn how to read through the way they provide. And it starts, of course, with the general literacy. And I was just thinking, they don't even promote hooks or phonics or things like that. If they do, I guess it's on the cable channels for all the cartoons. And you would think during a pandemic, that would have been a perfect time to bring that back to the forefront. Because if everybody's kid was at home, they could make sure their kid learned how to read with hook for phonics. I remember that all the time when I was little. I remember reading in fundamental commercials when I was little. All of that, I don't know where it went, it's gone. And I mean, these were commercials on during quote unquote adult programs like Soul Train. I know kids watch Soul Train, but you know, they had mostly adult performers and things like that, you know, throughout the week. And so literacy is very important. You want to be, I don't want to say you want to be like me, but I don't remember being illiterate. My mother and father made sure I learned how to read and count. I don't remember not knowing how to do that. And you want your children to at least, I think, do that. Again, I don't have children, but I was a child and I have grown up to be an adult. And the practical things that we need, that we know we need to have as adults, we need to make sure we start teaching them to our children, not just our physical children, but our cousins or whoever, as soon as possible. Thank you.
Right on, right on. Much obliged, ma'am. I can repeat Dr. Welsing two times. If you were folks who were listening in early, I was playing the segment where Dr. Welsing visited us 10 years ago to the date. It was a Sunday, and she was talking about white supremacy racism, the maximum master form of terrorism in the known universe. All that said, I can repeat Dr. Welsing twice. Reading is more important than watching television. When you play around with sex, the joke is on the offspring. They will not think it's funny not being able to read, especially as we get closer to 2030 and all the rest of it. In fact, you can think right now, you have, they say, black children who are not able to read on level. Jeff Bezos went to Pluto. Black children can't read on level in mass. White people are leaving the planet. I think even a lot of children can, black children can register that, non-white children can register that at a very early age. Like, wow. Anywho, number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks can let us know if you had easy access to firearms at 13. And or if you think you could get materials to construct pipe bombs. Even the security camera information for your school at 13. If you think you could get all that, you know, those details together, let us know. Well, folks, before I see if other folks have comments here to share, questions, counter-racist suggestions, let me just say one thing for the book club. I'm not a Woody Allen fan. I didn't know anything about Woody Allen before we started reading his autobiography, Apropos of Nothing. We're about halfway through it, so we finally got to the reason why we read this book, the tragic arrangement, insert cowbell, and how he and Sun Yi ended up being married. Sun Yi is a non-white female who was adopted from Korea, and she is 35 years younger than Woody Allen, white male. So we finally got to that part and him explaining everything. I post, as I do for all of our programs, on social media, Twitter, Facebook, all the other goofy sites. So I post for the book club, Woody Allen, Apropos of Nothing. There are individuals who I suspect they are white because they have white avatars, which doesn't mean anything per se. But they're posting and just caping for Woody Allen, for people who are listening in different parts of the world or what have you, meaning they're writing commentary to defend and support Woody Allen. Like, what do you mean? Like, and this has been going on for weeks, really, since we started reading the book. The most recent ones, they come on. I posted Woody Allen. We read the section this week in the book where he talks about taking Polaroid pictures of Sun Yi. She's in her early 20s. Now, I said 20. Some of this imprecision is in the book. I talked about this on Thursday. It's not like he's putting exact dates and times, how old she was, how old I was, for every step of the way. Sometimes it's kind of vague. So I said she was 20 when this happened, when he's taking these raunchy pictures and leaving them out on his mantel place exposed, like they're not hidden in some security box or under his mattress, out on the mantel place where he has cleaning people come in, other folks to his house. So I write this on social media, and they write back. See, there you go again, being dishonest. She was 21, not 20 years old. I don't know why you are totally discounting that Sun Yi is a grown, happy, married mother who says she is in a loving relationship, the way that you can just totally discount that. Same thing I told them today, like, hey, 2021 is all over 18, right? Legal age, right? It's not like I was saying she was 9, 15, trying to be slick or anything. 2021, legal age. Shouldn't be a problem there, right? All that notwithstanding, if you have this much time, because some of these folks have like Woody Allen as their avatar, like pictures of him from different movies or different parts of his life, which also leads me to suspect that these might be white people. If you have this much time in the middle of a global health pandemic and everything else that's happening, hurricanes, floods, wildfires, all the rest of the things that are happening, vaccine mandates and all the rest, to cape for a suspected child molester. I hope this is equal opportunity support. So you can also support Bill Cosby and Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, R. Kelly going through his trial right now. I hope you can pick out some other folks who have charges, accusations similar to Woody Allen, and you'll go out and defend them too. Absolutely horrendous, in my opinion. 35 years age difference. Like, and then you want to sit around and nitpick about those type of details where she was 21, not 20. That doesn't make it any better, different at all. More for Woody Allen in the book club. That'll be Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. What does it mean to be white? Said that before. Like, wow, the sexual deviance abounds. That was even mentioned in the segment on 9/11. They didn't just say Guantanamo Bay and a part of the security apparatus, Homeland Security, shout the irritated genie. They said abusing prisoners, Guantanamo Bay, where we can detain and don't even have to charge you with anything, indefinite detention, they called it. Detain, and then we can do all kinds of torture, sexual abuse. Why does that have to be an aspect of it? You can't just kill a person. You got to castrate them. Got to be some sort of sexual torture. Why does that have to be? What is that about? Continuing with the book club. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564. #943#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, not for spectators, should be at least some folks with some thoughts about the firearms. Certainly if we have callers in Florida, my goodness, how are you staying alive? What are your thoughts about these teenage gangsters who are plotting to blow up? They weren't just going to shoot the people at the school. It's not just enough to go in and shoot them. We got to get pipe bombs and blow up the place too. Racist man, racist woman, racist child. President Obama lied to us. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, callers and listeners. I did not have access to firearms at the age of 13, nor access to the production of pipe bombs, nor was I thinking about any of those things at all. And that case reminds me, I don't know if it was last year or this year, because just white children terrorists are just so frequent these days. But there was a racist child female and a racist child male who they just get in some sort of shootout with law enforcement recently, and they were, of course, spared, did not die, of course. A lot of all of the broadcasts, just a tragic reminder that this problem is very, very incorrect, and it produces a lot of I don't want to use any metaphors, so it's just really incorrect. And I have some news to report on my end. There's a really interesting case. The folks want a really strict example of what it means to be a white parent and how white people really don't care about children at all. The name is Jeanette Maples. Look up that case and see what you think. And I'll mute my line right now.
Jeanette Maples. Okay. We'll check this one out and see. Eugene, here we go to Oregon again, right down the road from me. My goodness. Let's see. Eugene, the woman originally sentenced to death row for abusing her 15-year-old daughter, Jeanette Maples, abusing her daughter to death in 2009, will spend the rest of her life in prison without the possibility of parole. A judge in July 2019 vacated Angela McAnulty. Wow, what a name. McAnulty's guilty plea in the murder of her daughter, finding, among other flaws, that her attorneys failed her by allowing her to plead guilty at the outset of her trial in 2011. McAnulty, now 51, appeared by video conference this week at a hearing to approve a new settlement. She no longer faces death. Instead, McAnulty will spend the rest of her life behind bars without the possibility of parole. She abused her. This is like she beat her to death or something. Like, I don't even know if I want the details. Like, my goodness. And then they had to save her life. Like, geez. Oh, yeah, they do give the details about it. I'll have to, they give the details about it. Savage. What does it mean to be white? Eesh. And they do not care about children. The teens that he mentioned. The other case, excellent memory. He said it seemed like there was another case where some teens ran wild and were shooting at police officers and all the rest of it. Seemed like it happened within the last year or so. Absolutely correct. That happened not in the last year. That happened June, just a couple weeks ago, really. And this is in Florida, too. That's what I said. They have been cutting a fool. That is a metaphor, but I mean, woo. It is so dangerous. I'm so glad we did the retreat in Florida way back before all this got started. Like, I'm not going to Florida anytime soon. Like, if we gotta, in order to replace white supremacy with justice, requires visiting the states of Florida, or Virginia is not going to happen in my lifetime, because I am not going back to those areas. Virginia, like, ever, if I can help it. And Florida, like, whew, it's not looking attractive. So the case he was talking about, teen to be charged as adult, 12-year-old as juvenile in shootout with Volusia deputies. Now, that's 12. I asked for 13. So at 12, do you think you could get access to an AK-47? The details on this one, because we talked about this, it was just weeks ago. The Volusia County State Attorney announced charges Thursday against two juvenile runaways accused of opening fire on deputies with guns found inside a home they broke into. Again, pause for Tamir Rice. Jonathan Crawford III, really. Whole lot of folks we can include in that, but they had toy guns. Didn't come out nearly as well as these folks who were engaged in a shootout. A 14-year-old girl who was shot by deputies after they say she pointed a shotgun at them. Come on, I don't even want to. Their name should be in here too. And they're not even named. They're not even named. These folks should be named. If you're out with a shotgun shooting at deputies, I think they had an assault rifle too. They should be named. Like, and they would have been named if they were black. What does it mean to be white? Racist man, racist woman, racist child. Much obliged, sir. Other folks who, good memory. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up. If you have commentary to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter in Florida. Dangerous land you got down there.
Yeah, I looking both ways as I stick my head up out of the hole that I'm in. I did not have access to a firearm when I was 13, although I wanted to. I always was interested in firearms. So around that and warfare itself, history, I definitely was studying such things when I was 13 years old to know enough to understand that white people in general there's no disconnect between white people in general and nuclear weapons. Anything from a 22 rusty pistol to a nuclear bomb, there's no disconnect with white people. So they're going to have access to it. They are the inventors of metal objects that fire metal projectiles in an explosive manner. And that was one of the main artificial instruments to secure global racism, white supremacy. So those, if you have an understanding of that, then you would have an understanding to know that a 13-year-old is not the youngest white people that have access to firearms. I've seen as young as 6, 7 years old with the grandfather allowing his grandchild to shoot to death a deer that's about the size of a Volkswagen. And literally the grandfather had tears in his eyes because of his grandson being able to kill this animal. DCS program, third session, primarily, two of the highlights was for each of the we have a younger group and the older fellas, and we separate the two at certain occasions. When we have them inside and we are basically communicating with each other, we would rather have the young people themselves to do most of the expression. I mean, nobody want to sit up and listen to the old retired firefighter to be talking and whatnot. I want to hear what they have to say about themselves or the world around them. So the first day today, we asked them about to express on what do you like to do? What would you want as a profession, and how do you see yourself going about doing it? I was gratified to see that there were only two that mentioned something about professional sports. The less of that, the better. We don't need another basketball player for the NBA. We don't need another NFL player. We do need doctors, lawyers, scientists, people of that profession nature. And they did pretty well as far as expressing themselves. And then I would, ask them some questions if I thought it was necessary. We did watch a movie. I'll just mention a title and not going to expound on it at all. I think you have a restriction on that. American Skin was the name of it. Spike Lee had something to do with it. I just can't remember the name of the quote unquote central actor in the movie. If somebody said his name, I would be able to recall it. Other than that,
Nate Parker, Cowbell.
Yeah. That's who it was. Yeah. Other than that, last thing, as I do a lot on watching the cows, I mean, not watching, listen to the cows on Saturdays. I do watch football as a football coach, not as a fan, so to speak. But I'm watching this game with the volume down. It's the University of Michigan playing, I believe, the University of Washington. And they're at the stadium in Michigan that is nicknamed the Big House. This place has had over 100,000 people at every single game that they've played in that stadium since the late 1960s, every single football game. This place is crowded. My eye to brain memory, it only looks like it's full of just white people. Nobody has a mask. Nobody has a mask at all in the stadium. And we're talking about over 100,000 people. And it's so crowded that it would give a person claustrophobia. It's so crowded. I haven't seen nobody with a mask. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Dang. Much obliged, retired firefighter. I guess so many points just on that last one alone, man. I guess one, now I am in Seattle, literally walking distance from Husky Stadium, where the University of Washington football team plays, that is visiting the Big House in Michigan tonight. I am sure there are many, many taverns throughout these parts where they are watching that very game. And disgruntled for many reasons. They lost their opener last week, and that was laughable, too. Hope they lose every game. Tyrone Willingham, when he was black coach here, hope they lose forever. Anyway, they call it the Big House. Now, that's the second time that phrase was used on this program. That's what they called the plantation where they went to hide out from Hurricane Ida the big house.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, interesting. I mean, over 100,000 people continuously without no difference since the late 1960s. And everybody has gold T-shirts, and they have gold shakers. It looks like something from another planet. It's so many people, but nobody has a mask that I've seen in any of the scenes. I thought that was kind of interesting.
All I can say, I'm not surprised when I think of Michigan. That was where they were going to kidnap the governor because they were upset about her COVID restrictions. So as much as football is below, I think the Big Ten Conference where Michigan plays, they were one of the ones they were talking about shutting football down, and the white people went berserk about all of that in Ohio.
Oh,
and other
yeah.
places. Like, what? We can't watch these niggers run around
they
and
were
get
riot.
Talk about it. They were hot last year, and then they went ahead and did their kind of late cobbled together season. So yeah, I'm not surprised that they're there with no masks. And they said it was going to be like that, like in here in Seattle, like when the Seahawks for their home games, you have to wear a mask if you go to the state. I forgot what it's called, but you have to wear, if you want to go see Russell Wilson, you have to wear a mask. And I think even if you want to, if that game had been played here, you'd had to wear a mask. You wouldn't have been, you could have seen the fans in the stadium, they have that, but you have to wear a mask on and all the rest of it. Like they just put that rule back in at the beginning of the month. So that sort of, you know, this is going to be a problem for a very long time. Gus T wanted to go to the University of Michigan, was accepted at the University of Michigan, would have been right there acting a fool with the white people in the stands, yelling and acting a fool and probably catching Lord knows what. Much obliged, retired firefighter in Florida. So thus far, no one has shared that they had access to guns, although retired firefighter did say that he's seen where white children did have that sort of access and got to go out and hunt, you know, big time game and elk and all the rest of it. I, too, have seen and heard of that. White people getting, you know, firearm training at 5, 6, 7. Got their first gun as a Christmas gift from the parents and that sort of thing. I've heard, seen that seems to be a strong part of white culture.
Yes, definitely.
Let's see.
Before the description that I gave of deadly weapons, it was just people throwing things like rocks or a sharp branch called a spear. You know, that's all it was before the white people with these projectiles that would explode a metal object out of a metal muzzle, which ended up becoming something called a rifle. You know, that sort of thing. They created all of that. They created all of that to end up in a expedient amount of time to rule the planet Earth. And far as I know, they're still in charge.
Still in charge at the big house and beyond. Folks should think about that as well. Like, I don't, that phrase, the big house, in terms to the plantation, that has been in use for a very long time, way before the Michigan football team was out on the gridiron. So wherever that nickname started at, and saying, hey, we've packed all these, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of folks in here to watch this ball game with our black athletes. The big house. Yeah, nice ring to it. The language of white supremacy racism might even tell you a lot about how they relate. The folks that are coming in droves, 100,000 people to come in and watch this ball game, might even tell you what they're thinking about all of this if this is the big house. Words are important. Say that again. My man Mr. Riley playing word games down in Florida while he's locked up. Let's see. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Folks still asking, did you have access to firearms? Instructions on pipe bombs at the age of, well, I guess we can lower it now to 12 since we brought in that other story at 12, 13, middle school age. Did you have access to any of this sort of weaponry training? Let us know that one. Or if you have, we have any folks with their 911 recollections as well. Did we miss someone?
Does. And Cal callers. So can you hear me okay? I'm sorry.
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Okay. I do want to say that with that access, you know, we knew when I was coming up, we knew that my grandmother carried a gun, my grandfather, my mom, most of my aunts and all of my uncles, right? So we all knew that when we were little. And so did we have access to the guns? Well, you weren't brave enough to, and we knew where they kept the guns, but we weren't brave enough to go in there and grab one of them people's guns because we were mad at somebody at school and we were going to go and handle whatever anger issues we was having with a student at school. We wouldn't have never did it. So did we have access in my household and in my family? I don't know. We knew where they were, but we didn't. We weren't brave enough to go do nothing like that, to go grab one of their guns and then go shoot up somebody. So is that access? I mean, I guess we physically, but mentally in our heads, we knew we would get in big trouble with our family for going and grabbing one of their guns and doing something. So I did want to put that in there. Thank you.
Much obliged. That sounds like responsible gun ownership, right? Where this is not a toy and we can go in and snatch this and I'm upset or I just want to go brandish this and brag, show off to folks. I remember family members who had firearms, but same type of thing. It was never something where I could go and get this and show this off. I certainly would not have thought, ooh, I can go get this and take this to school. Like, absolutely not. That sounds like, if anything, that sounds like a very different type of access than, oh yeah, I got it in my backpack right now, ready to roll. Mm-hmm. They're fitting to get it tomorrow. Like, they think it's going to be dodgeball. Psh, we'll have them dodging all right. Like, what? What does it mean to be white? Let's see. Oh, that was what I meant to say. Now, when I spoke with B in Toronto, she said, man, did I do something wrong, Gus? Did I mess up on the program or say something? And I was like, I'm trying to remember now. Like, did you? Like, I don't remember anything. What are you talking about? And she said, well, I tried to call in and I would just get so much interference. I would just be blocked here and blocked there and I just couldn't get in. I didn't know if I did something and you were restricting access. I said, man, racist, A pluses. We have had so many people. We've been on the air for 12 plus years. It's been 12 plus years of sabotage. We have had so many people who have shared, and even got, I'm in this number too, who have reported having all kinds of difficulties dialing into the program. As I said, me too. It was for a while. I would have to dial in about 15 minutes early because I would expect a good 5 minutes of interference and just really wacky things, things that would never happen any other time, any other number that I attempt to dial. And we had other, we had a young lady, she dialed in live on the air and said, I've been trying to call in. I counted on my cell phone. I had to call in 32 times. 32. Now, that's not 80 visits like those teens down in Florida, but still 32 times. It's been lots of that. I think Robin, Wisconsin, and we had other folks who said, oh, man, now they're charging me like $5 a minute to call into the cows and all these wacky like fees and things. Like, it has totally been 12 plus years of sabotage. much obliged for the folks who have persevered to dial in, Gus T included. But that is some of the disruption right there. People trying to call in and being obstructed for some reason. Usual suspects. Other people who were able to chime in, if you have thoughts, observations to share. Let's see. Line should be open. While folks are getting their thoughts together, for one, hopefully folks are able to hear Anitra Brown. She was with us, is that Wednesday? Yes, this past Wednesday she was with us. Normally she would be in Louisiana, but she evacuated to Texas. Hopefully they said like 95% of the folks in Louisiana, in New Orleans, but 95% of the people in New Orleans have their electricity back at this point. So hopefully she and her daughter have been able to return and get back to some semblance of normalcy. But it was grand to have her on the broadcast again. That was a snippet from that broadcast this past week where she was talking about climate change as environmental racism and the impact that it's having specifically on black residents in the New Orleans area and Southeast Louisiana area in general. Same thing that they were talking about on Democracy Now! In the areas that are either without power and even talking about the disproportionate number of power outages that they have in that area compared to the amount of money that they have to pay monthly for their electricity. Ms. Brown talked about that exactly and saying that they spend so much money, we should have way better services where we're not out of power for 2 weeks, making us have to stay away from our residences and being able to clean up and even making it more difficult for the cleanup process and all of this with Hurricane Ida. We should have dependable, reliable service all the time for as much as we pay, and especially in these sort of critical moments. Environmental racism, white supremacy, another form of terrorism right there. Let's see. Other folks with commentary that they want to make sure they get in. No spectating.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida. Now, did I get it correct? Are you near the Polk County area?
I'm close to it, but I'm in a different county, Alachua County, where University of Florida is. They have all of the Tim Tebow statues and stuff.
Gators, go Gators, right?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. Now, I'm glad that you played that segment from Polk County, because now we have had some people come to our courthouse that used to work at the Polk County courthouse, and I've even seen a CLIC member post that she wants racist suspect Grady Judd to run for the governor, and she wants DeSantis to run for president. So she's obviously, I don't know, this might be a metaphor, MAGA supporter, but a suspected racist. Because I've seen there are all kinds of posts that involve the sheriff, Ray Judd, but that was a local report that I do remember seeing. I don't know if there was a form of information of were the victims white or non-white. I'm not sure. But there was a site that showed the names of the Volusia County, the white girl, Nicole Jackson, 14, yeah, like 14 years old, on the Volusia Sheriff website. And I think the 12-year-old name was Travis O'Brien. But another thing I remember about that story was that foster home or whatever home that was that they, I guess, escaped from or whatever, said that they got 300 calls, 300, in the year 2020. The story or the audio where they had the mentioning of the release on recognizance, I think that's another interesting one, because it seems like a lot of white people get that kind of benefit to where they don't have to pay any money. And the Jackie Johnson, I believe that was another segment, a white woman using her position as a white person to help support the three racists that killed the victim of racism, Ahmaud Arbery. And I also been meaning to mention, there was a story in California on the West Coast that there was these young racists, and I thought about that audio segment with President Obama, that they're better than we are, like, in my opinion. Like, I don't know if he meant that, but in my opinion, I just think that they are improving on how to practice racism. And, you know, I just thought about that. And I think it's called Salinas High School. They had this black doll. They were calling it Shaniqua. And it's a lot of pictures on her Instagram. Like, they made this Instagram page. And from the news reports that I've seen, they were mistreating the doll, stomping on the doll, running over the doll. In their cars, vehicles, had the doll's head stuck in the sunroof part of the vehicle. Comments like, Abby meets Shawnigwa, like the spelling, like it was spelled Shawniggua. So obviously they're trying to say nigga or nigger. And these high, they said all of the cheerleaders that got suspended were white, the white cheerleaders. But see, they made sure to say, oh, well, you know, they also had a black and Hispanic girl, I guess, get suspended too or something. But that was a real major story that was going on a couple weeks ago. And I'll end off saying that there were 4 bomb threats at Buholz High School, like right up the street. And the thing that I think is an act of white supremacy is that they haven't even found this person. I strongly believe that they have the resources to find who this is. I suspect it's someone who's classified as white, but yeah. They started school back on August the 19th. It's 9/11, it's September 11th now, so there's been 4 bomb threats where the children at the high school had to evacuate the classes like 4 times. So that's all I have to share. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
White people do not care about children. Times 4. That would be another one. I strongly suspect if it had been Bill Cosby, Nate Parker, suspected of calling in these threats, I think they would have been quicker about putting a stop to that. That's a lot of time and energy. I have to keep moving students out of class and all that. Like, anywho, the folks in Polk County, like Ron DeSantis, 2024, I'm not surprised at all. I remember, I feel like it's been a whole lot of that sort of attitude in Polk County. I think they were the ones last year. I think they made the statement like, you all can do all that protesting and George Floyd and everything else. You come around here, we're going to have law and order. I think it was the same like posse group of sheriff and lawmen who had basically the same kind of talk, because they came around this time and they said this Riley fella with PTSD and all the rest of it, decorated veteran, he goes out and commits these heinous crimes, shoots this 11-year-old girl and kills this little baby and all the rest. And they say, hey, he has on his body armor and he wanted to get into a gun battle with the enforcement officers. Then when he got shot, he surrendered. And he said, we wanted to shoot him. We would have shot him a lot. Is that the sort of attitude that peace officers, that's what they call them? Peace officers? Like, man, oh, we would have tore him up. I had my pistol. I was ready. We would have shot. Like, what? I thought it was supposed to be about preservation of life, not, oh, man. Oh, why did he have to throw it down? Like, oh. And now, I have seen way too many times excessive force and George Floyd and all the rest of it where, hey, if it's a non-white person, black person, and they have done something dastardly like this, oh, man, we put it on them. You're going to get a headlock and a beat down and an elbow smash and all the rest of it. Like, what the world? Come out and talk about how you wanted to. Like I said, either way, that's not great. I'm not saying it would have been good if he had done all that. I'm just saying, like, man, you don't do all that, and then you come out as opposed to just being professional, and suspect was apprehended without gunfire, going through the legal process. No, he was a coward. Wish we could have shot him a lot. That's the sort of attitude that is very prevalent in the system of white supremacy, in my opinion. Now, the case now, this is not in Florida. The other young folks, where they had all the call. Oh, there was the one in Florida. It was Volusia County, where it was the 14-year-old and the 12-year-old. They got in the gun battle with the deputies. And he said they, the wherever the facility that they escaped from, juvenile facility, I reckon, they had received 300 calls. The folks who were going to do the children, teens who were going to do the pipe bombing and all the rest of it, 80 calls. The juvenile facility, 300 calls. How many black people do you think they're going to tolerate having to come back again and again and again, especially if this is something related to violence? Anywho, and Jackie Johnson, forgot. Now, she was the district attorney. They said she was showing some sort of bias, favoritism to these suspected race soldiers who killed Ahmaud Arbery. And it wasn't just that case. They said, wait a minute, because the case that they talked about in the sound clip where it was a male convicted of child molestation, that was a black person who was convicted, but they were saying, hey, I think she lied in this case to prosecute him about the ages and all of that. They were saying, I think there needs to be a review of all of her cases because it might be the same sort of what they're calling bias, favoritism, white supremacy, racism. This might be a pattern in the way that she has practiced law as a prosecuting attorney. Maybe. Jackie Johnson, white woman, can't have a system of racism without white women. Let's see. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Man, he mentioned Tim Tebow and all the statues that he has peppering the, I guess, Florida region, North Florida region. If that name and image likeness was in existence, like, Tim Tebow would probably be a billionaire. Like, all of the merchandising, like, he would own the state of Florida. Like, for reals. Like, he wouldn't even matter. Like, what he did, NFL and all that, he would be a total billionaire. Tim Tebow land in Florida. He could be on the ticket with Ron DeSantis for 2024. Let's see. Other folks, commentary that they want to make sure they get in. double check, make sure folks don't have any other commentary that we are missing out on. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. The book club will be here at minimum on Thursday. Man, I can only say I was not like excited about the prospect of reading. I didn't know anything about Woody Allen, but man, reading the book, I'm so glad that we picked this one. Like, it's everything. It's not even just the racism, white supremacy, and this is a major white people don't care about children, sexual deviance, targeting children, why nothing can be done about that, the Boy Scouts and the Catholic Church, and it just goes on and on and on. Jerry Sandusky, Jeffrey Epstein, Harvey Weinstein, just goes on and on and on. Why can't something be done about this? This is a part of white culture. I'm so glad we read the book. I have learned quite a bit. What does it mean to be white? And it's not just that. It's also Woody Allen, all of his fetishizing of black males. That was not expected, but wow, there's so much of it. And the same thing Dr. Gerald Horn, when he talked about white people, particularly white males, putting themselves in position where they can ogle and get sexual gratification from black males. That is Woody Allen all day long. Black male jazz entertainers, black male basketball players, baseball players, like, it is a pattern throughout his life. I'm so glad the passage that I read where he talks about hypothetically Charles Oakley waking up in his bed and Charles Oakley is hovering over top of him. Like I said, then what male thinks about that? Anybody here, you think about some black athlete hovering over you while you're in bed? Homoeroticism through and through. I'm so glad. And talking about caping for child molesters and sexual deviants, caping for Marv Albert, talking about, man, it's a disgrace the way they did old Marv. This was back in the day when they kicked him off after he was charged, accused of sodomizing a female and biting her. He was upset because she wouldn't participate in a three-way. Ends up getting found guilty of these sex crimes, and then he gets it expunged from his record later so that he can come back and get back to broadcasting basketball games and do his farewell tour this year. He just retired officially like a couple weeks ago. This is Marv Albert. All this is online. They got his mugshots and everything. Woody Allen writing, man, I miss old Marv. Shame what they did to old Marv. He was charged with sodomy. What are you talking about? Like, what does it mean to be white? I'm so glad we read Woody Allen's autobiography in the book club archives. If you need to check it out, get more detail. Let's see. I'll tell folks maybe 5 minutes or so. See if they have any other thoughts they want to make sure they get in before we get ready to wrap things up. Yes, sir.
The usual suspects have been talking about the 9/11. I remember being in fifth grade, and then when it happened, and then in middle school, when I was around white people, white kids, white children, for nutrition and lunch, we would spend our time watching these racist cartoons of non-white males, so-called Taliban, Al-Qaeda. We used to watch videos of them being killed, and but it was comedy. We were watching cartoons of non-white people being killed, and it was fun. And that was like my first introduction around white people, is being exposed to that sort of content, and those sort of websites where you could watch violent cartoons, very, very racist cartoon, but I was very confused. I didn't know it was racism. And it's really incorrect, the whole 9/11 attack, or I don't even know what to call it, because allegedly the people who did it were allegedly the Saudi Arabia, but they went into Iraq and Afghanistan, which are not which is not Saudi Arabia. So it's really suspect, and if you one does their research, they can see that those places that the usual suspects went into are places that have a lot of resources that the white supremacists have no control of. I wish I could, no metaphor, so I'm just going to mute my line.
Much obliged. Words are important. Mr. Riley was playing word games, just being conscious about what we say. The 9/11, talk about master deception and the racist cartoons. Now, again, white people are not ignorant about racism. Maybe even the racist children aren't ignorant either. Like, what do you mean? They got racist cartoons at this age? Like, whoa. Not ignorant. They know exactly what they are doing. Spike Lee was mentioned, a retired firefighter. He was talking about the project with Nate Parker. Spike Lee did some sort of documentary. I haven't seen it, but it just recently was released. He did a documentary that deals with 9/11, and apparently some part of the content, I think this is an HBO project, but some portion of this documentary questioned the official narrative in terms of what happened on 9/11. Did these, you know, Muslim hijackers with box cutters come in and do all of this, and that's what caused Building 7, World Tower Center 7, to fall? That's what caused all that to happen? These Muslim terrorists who took this plane over and all the rest of it? Like, apparently a portion of his documentary deviated from that and made space for what they're calling conspiracy theories and people who do not think what we have been told, don't believe that that's what happened. That's not how these buildings fell. That's not how these buildings were felled. I think that there was some sort of explosive device inside or something else. Apparently enough people complained, and so that portion of the content was excised for future broadcasts. Now I'm really interested to see, you know, what was said originally in terms of the content. What did he say, or who did he interview about all of this? But it seems like there's been a lot of that. It's 20 years on. Like, I think some of the folks commented saying, our caller just now saying he was in fifth grade, and you got some folk, hey, not born at all when all of this took place. So they can be extremely effective at squashing alternative narratives and just saying that that's nonsense. This is what happened. And anybody who has anything else to say is ignorant, a crackpot. They're making things up because there were a lot of white people who had lots of suspicion about the official narrative of what happened on September 11, 2001. But seems like they're trying to be in unison now, 20 years on, and right on for GW getting the world right. Other folks, commentary that they want to make sure they get in.
I'll get back in there. I want to talk about the white men when it comes to child pedophilia. They don't care about children. That's real interesting about Woody Harrelson with the black men. I'm behind. I'm just now finishing Labyrinth, so I'm gonna start on that. But yeah, Woody Allen, you know, but he doesn't. I thought Woody Allen didn't really hire black people to play in any of his movies. So that's interesting how he fantasizes about, I guess, black men. I'd have to start reading the book with y'all, but I wanted to say about the child pedophilia with white men. I mean, it's not funny, but we read a book here on the couch. I mean, I read it along with everyone else. If you remember the Reconstruction of White Supremacy in the beginning of the book, and this was that book? I think it was like maybe the 1800s or something when it first got started, but I could be wrong, early 1900s. But they were going back and forth about the legal age of consent, and it was already low. I think it was like 15 years old, and they were like in the Senate of where the guy is, the main character in the book, the person, the senator, whatever he was,
Clemson. Do you remember that, Gus, when you read that? And it was like a big thing. They didn't want it to go like up to 16. They wanted to keep that 15. Could even been 14, if you remember what I'm talking about. So they don't care anything about children and child pedophilia. That's standard operating procedure when it comes to white people too. I'm sure white women do it, but yeah. Do you remember that, Gus? Remember that book we read?
I do. It's vaguely, I hadn't thought of it until you mentioned it, but now thinking back on it, Ben Tillman, Reconstruction of White Supremacy.
Ben Tillman, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Former governor in South Carolina, former presidential candidate. I was talking about Ron DeSantis. Pitchfork Ben Tillman was going to run for president as well. But I do remember that at the beginning of the book, and she's exactly right. The age of consent was very low because the book starts out like right after the Civil War Reconstruction. So it's like late 1900s and then, or excuse me, late 1800s and then going into the 20th century. But like it was already, the age of consent was already very low at that time period. And as she said, there was lots of wrangling. Like it was not, oh yes, let's preserve, you know, white womanhood and, yes, let's let them mature. No. Doesn't need to go up that high. Like, and I think they were only talking about bringing it up to like 16. It's not like they were talking about 18 or, you know, something really wild and outrageous. Like, just a year or two, and there was lots of opposition from white men who were substantially older than 20. Don't care about children at all. Let's see. I'm trying to see if I can find that in the... I'm not next to my book because I narrated that for the book club, Ben Tillman and the Reconstruction of White Supremacy. But I'm trying to see if I can find it in my text before we rock and roll out of here for the day. Other folk might be able to do it before the last few moments before we get ready to wrap up. Any other comments, thoughts, observations folks wanted to make sure they share?
Can I be heard again?
Retired firefighter in Florida? Yes, sir.
Yes. As a firefighter myself and a few others, always thought that was something that explosions that took place on the inside of those buildings. Those buildings, from what I had been told, was constructed by the strongest element of steel that was ever produced in a building. That's not the first time that airplanes have crashed into buildings in New York. The Empire State Building had bombers to fly into the structure by accident, and the building didn't collapse. So with the advent of knowing about a certain amount of heat that it would take for steel to collapse like everyone saw, we didn't think that was correct. That it was something that took place on the inside. Also, during that time, I was on duty at the time. I've mentioned this before on the cows. I was on duty at the time. At that period of time, when that was taking place in New York City, we would be doing what is called station duties after you've already checked your equipment. And the officers answered the morning radio call, that sort of thing. You did station duties. Mine was to clean up the day room, tidy up the day room. The day room is the area that's connected with a kitchen, a dining table, television set. And of course, as I'm cleaning up, first thing I would do is turn on television. As soon as I turned on the television, there was the two tall buildings, and smoke was coming from one of them. I understood right then and there that that was not, that was something deliberate. Nothing accidental happens like that in such a building so tall, so high up as far as storage is concerned. Within about, I would say 30 to 40 minutes, I was looking at that at home because I was not going to be in that uniform on duty if something expanded to a national or global type of situation. I was not going to be in that uniform at the time. They would have to find me to have me to come back somewhere, which they probably would have some trouble in doing so. So I made a reason to leave when I witnessed seeing that on television. And that's what I was wanted to bring up. Thank you.
Intelligent retired firefighter, and a lot of folks just trying to use common sense. I know Back of the Bus started the Cows Together 2007, well after 9/11, relatively speaking. But I remember he used to talk all the time, Building 7, just trying to use logic. Like, what is your reasoning for that building's collapse? Plane didn't hit it, and you're just saying fire? Like, really? Does that happen? Like, where buildings that are made of steel just fall down all of a sudden from fire? Like, really? Lots of questions that, again, just got totally silenced before my memory goes bad and I forget. Ben Tillman and the Reconstruction of White Supremacy. So I'm narrating it again. This is page 241. Momentary agreement with Smalls did not alter Ben Tillman's view of black women as immoral and degraded. When the opportunity arose, he gave vent to sexual slanders against black women as a group. As far as sexual relations go, he wrote to a Kansas correspondent, black women are little better than animals. He believed that they usually did not resist white men's sexual advances. This, he thought, was a result of generations of slavery having been taught that whites are superior. Black women believed that having a child by a white man was a mark of improved status. Cal Bell. This explained the complacence of Negro women who, according to Tillman, were nearly always more than willing to gratify a white man's lust. This view of black women caused Tillman to balk at raising the state's age of consent. Sally Chapman denounced the state's current age of consent, 10, as a foul, formally petitioned the convention to raise the age to 18. Over the course of discussion and debate, however, the age of consent gradually fell back to 16, then to 15, and finally to 14. White woman's rhetorical antipode, black women's complacence, was the magnet drawing it down. Tillman was among those who feared that if age of consent were raised too high, innocent white men might be entrapped and legally ruined by adolescent black seductresses. And that is footnoted. Yikes. 91. Woof. In the archives, you can go back. We read. Oh, she's just.
Guys, it's boring in the beginning, but it's a good book. Everybody should go back and listen to that book. Thanks, guys.
Reading is more important than watching television. And this one specifically, I did narrate it, but that doesn't mean anything. Listening to this was played at the time right after Dylan Storm Roof went to that church for those executions. That was the reason we read this book, in fact. South Carolina's finest. Anywho, we will get ready to wrap things up this week. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Minimum will be here on Thursday for the book club. Just have to check Black Talk Radio Network for other times and programs and all the rest of it. Hope everybody is safe, especially if you're in Florida, but beyond safe. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy racism. We need our brain computer to solve this problem. In addition to being sober, if you're out and about, if you see someone, they're being hostile and loud, exit. This is not a time to confront strangers. You should be thinking they could be armed. In addition to all that, if you're going out driving, you are sober, trying to minimize contact with the Mark Furmans of the known universe, and we need all of our attention. All of that said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. No name calling. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.